It's time for Mac Break Weekly. Alex, Andy, and Renee are all here. We're going to talk about the 10th anniversary of the Apple App Store. A couple of rumors, one not true about Apple and Intel, one might be true about new MacBooks and iPads, and can we actually crack the new USB security on iOS 11? It's all coming up next on Mac Break Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Mac Break Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 618, recorded Tuesday, July 10th, 2018. App Store turns 10. Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by Quip, the first subscription electric toothbrush accepted by the American Dental Association. Visit getquip.com/twit to get your first refill pack free when you purchase any Quip electric toothbrush. And by Tres Pontas, freshly roasted gourmet coffee shipped directly to you. Visit trespontes.com/MacBreak and use the code MacBreak to save 20% off every bag of coffee in your subscription. It's time for Mac Break Weekly, the show where we cover the latest news from Apple with Renee Ritchie of iMore.com. Hello, Renee.
Hi, Leo. Pleasure to be back with you all.
Plants. You have plants.
Yes, and these are the ones I have not yet killed. I'm very bad with plants. I'm trying my best. I thought I needed some organics.
Looks like a rubber tree. Oops, there goes another rubber tree plant. is that a rubber tree over your left shoulder?
Thanks. Georgia Dow helped me do the planting because she knows things about organics. And
yes.
Yeah. Nice. She told me what they were. I do not remember what they were, so I apologize. But I think rubber sounds familiar.
And I can't tell what the one over the right shoulder is. That's definitely not a rubber tree. I don't know what it is.
No. And I killed the unkillable cactus, so I'm not doing well.
You killed a cactus?
I think I overwatered it.
Oh, yeah. That'll do. Andy Inako's also here. He has no plants. He's a wise man.
Well, please. Behind me, it used to be plants. Then I killed them and turned them into something that was useful for my purposes.
I've always
as humanity was intended to do in God's dominion.
I've always wanted a house filled like a Victorian, filled with ferns and plants everywhere. I've always wanted that. I have to marry a plant keeper because Lisa also has a brown thumb.
I hate to be your Zig Ziglar or motivational speaker, but you need to ask yourself, Leo, what is keeping you between yourself and your dream of owning ferns?
It's true.
I think it's you that's keeping you there.
There's something wrong with me. There's something flawed, deeply flawed in me that I can't keep a fern alive.
Yeah, but no, I think I'm on the same page as Renee. It's like when you get plants are not the first thing you think of when you like move into a new place. It's when you start looking at plants or like getting new dishware or tableware, that's when you realize that, okay, if I'm getting this picky about things, I must have completely moved in by now. I bought a huge set of like William Sonoma dinnerware like over the weekend because for the past 12 years, my dinnerware has been a set of like actual like insurance salvage like diner plates and bowls that I bought at Building 19, like the insurance salvage store that is no longer. And they're beautiful, but it's like, what if you want to have more than like three people over for dinner? And what if you need to convince them that you can afford things and that you acknowledge that perhaps salvage dinerware is not necessarily the fancy eaten plates that you have when they're guests over? So
it's so funny because when you first set up a house, you buy, you go to Crate and Barrel or Pier 1, you buy plates. But when you first do it, salvage, then you buy plates when you get a little more sophisticated. And then by the time you're really sophisticated, you're doing salvage again. You go to antique stores. Alex Lindsay is also here. Vintage.
Yes.
Alex is the king of the Pixel Core. Alex Lindsay on the Twitter. Plants, no plants.
Some plants. We have figured out that the best way to keep the plants alive is to put the kids to work. So they water the plants.
Oh, that's smart.
They have it on their chores. And what I really found made a difference was that ball that holds water. You know, that you put the you fill it with
that's
water.
That's what I feel like. There's a technological solution.
Giant switch bin.
My son and I have been talking about it. We were like, for the plants, what we really need is a little waterer And then we need something that's going to measure the moisture, and then something that just drives the water. So that we're really interested in. The idea of actually having plants, not interested in. The idea of controlling them with a Raspberry Pi, very interested.
Here's the Raspberry Pi Pi Planter, a plant growth monitor with a sensor array. You know,
that's more complicated than
our friend Gary. runs an entire hydroponic greenhouse with Raspberry Pis.
And what is he growing in that hydroponic greenhouse?
No, he's not that kind of. lettuces and yeah, he does the thing where it's aquaponics, not hydroponics. Uh-huh. He has fish.
Oh wow!
And there's a whole ecosystem.
Right.
I think it's school grown. Let me see if I can get it right. And Gary's watching, I know, because he's a big fan. School-grown aquaponics at schoolgrown.org. And we should get him in sometime to show how he's used all of these technologies, including Raspberry Pi, to keep these things going. So he grows lettuces, but there's fish underneath, and then there's the fertilizer underneath the fish. I don't know. The fish make the fertilizer. The things do the things.
Then you just need a laser with some AI so it can see the difference between the bee and the mosquito, and it just zaps the
exactly.
mosquito.
Exactly. Zaps the mosquito, doesn't zap the bee. Look at these beautiful lettuces.
Amazing.
Oh, man. So they call it school grown because the initial market really is schools where they want kids to learn this whole cycle of things. You know, it'd be really cool if we could grow cupcakes. Cupcakes would be awesome.
Crazy cupcakes.
Yeah. I want aquaponic. We grew some cupcakes for Alex Lindsay, whose birthday it is. I've been stalling. Yay. Stalling
Happy
until
birthday,
the cupcakes
Alex.
Got back. Stalling.
Oh,
Happy
you.
Birthday, yes.
birthday
to you.
To you.
Happy birthday to you. You.
Happy birthday, dear Alex.
Happy birthday.
Okay. You can end it with a Donna Domero high C, Mr. Andy Nocco.
Happy birthday. To you. Anymore. I think that's the highest quality happy birthday song I've ever had sung to me. It's
like, never send a tenor to do a baritone's job.
Basso profondo.
So
I think I'm doing pretty well for 74.
Yeah, you look great, man.
Yeah, exactly.
He's catching up with Lisa.
Yeah,
careful.
It's amazing what a little gene editing can do, eh, Lindsay?
Yeah, exactly. I don't understand why people say that they make their age lower, because I feel like if you make it higher, everyone goes, wow, you're doing so well. If you make it lower, they're like, what happened to you, man?
Our sponsor today is Tres Puntas Coffee, so if you'd like a little coffee with your cupcakes. Actually,
I'm literally trying to dig my way through the screen and into your studio.
These are those fancy cupcakes with the. You don't have to eat them if you don't want to.
I have to eat one.
Yeah. You have to eat them.
At least take a bite. This is so good looking.
Jason, Chris, you want some cupcakes? Come on and
come have a cupcake.
Come and get them. Come on in.
Cupcakes.
Take your pick. You better get them now because
Lindsay's not going to let any of those cupcakes alive.
You don't want one? Oh, all right. Man, I wish I could eat one. A public service. Oh, go ahead, Burke. Burke gets the chocolate. Yum. A public service announcement on behalf of the CEO of Twit, LLC. Please friend Lisa Laporte on the Pokemon Go. Both Renee and I are maxed out at 200 friends. But if you befriend Lisa, you'll be my friend, too.
I'm now friends with Lisa Laporte.
By marriage. There's her trainer code, 1400-7295-5505. And we were talking before the show about how Pokemon, it's your fault because 2 weeks ago you picked it.
Yes.
And you said it's better and it's great. And I downloaded it, re-downloaded it, and got back into it. And I'm once again hooked. They really did improve it quite a bit.
They've added so many things. Yeah. They try to do a big update every 3 months. And they just, the summer one was the Alola. It keeps going, Leo. They had Friendship was the biggest one. And then before that, it was Field Research. And before that, it was Raid. And then a new gem system. And it keeps sucking me back in. Every time I finish it, I say, I'm done. And then they do something else.
iMore.com/Pokemon-go will give you everything you need to know.
We made a hub. We actually broke down and made a hub.
We have a hub. The Pokemon hub. Oh, my God. This is great. The Summer Survival Guide. Did you get a... Blastoise?
I did.
There was a whole Squirtle community day.
We got all the Squirtles. We got all the shiny Squirtles, all the sunglasses Squirtles, and all the shiny sunglasses Squirtles.
You're so good at this.
Then we went for ice cream, like all pros do.
So every month they do this, which is kind of cool.
It's a community day, and they started doing a raid day. And it's a little bit much because your whole weekend gets taken up. But they have like a raid day on the Saturday, then a community day on the Sunday. And each of them are 3 hours, and I don't know.
I was at a Japanese restaurant with my daughter yesterday, and I just quickly was, you know, just spinning the gems. And the waitress said, "Oh, did you get a Blastoise?" And I said, "Do you play?" She said, "No, my husband and son play nonstop. So I know all about Squirtle Day."
I've been trying to keep my kids away from it. Just keep them in the safe.
It's pretty addictive.
Yeah, I know.
Pretty addictive.
Are you guys worried that like the fish stocks outside in Nova Scotia that you're going to be overfished for Pokemon and you're not allowing them to like to rebuild their sort of populations?
They breed so fast, Andy. They breed so fast,
and there's so many new ones.
Parks are overfished.
But here's a question for Renee.
Yes, sir.
Lisa and I are fighting over this. This is how bad it's gotten.
Do I want to take sides? I don't know if I can.
We're getting there, and I'm getting, you know, there's a Squirtle, and I'm shooting for it. She says, "Don't get it. If you get it, I can't get it." And I said, "No, no. Whether I get it has nothing to do with whether you get it." Well, who's right?
But what?
They're unlimited, so you can catch as many. You both can catch the same one.
It doesn't matter if I catch some a Pokemon in my air while we're together.
Yeah,
she can still get it. It doesn't.
Everyone gets their own unique copy of it. Yeah.
What if we combined cryptocurrency with Pokemon, so that it would get slowly more difficult to get a hold of these.
This could be proof of work,
and then you could sell your Pokemon for thousands of dollars per Pokemon.
They're doing
trading now, so you could blockchain the trades to prove the authenticity.
But you could blockchain it and make it slowly become more and more each Pokemon character.
You've
be
seen
more and
Crypto
more popular.
Kitties, haven't you? That's Crypto Kitties, collectible, breedable, adorable. The thing is that there are people paying $100,000 for these digital cats.
Oh, man. Wow.
You can breed them, and then you get a unique kind.
Man, am I in the wrong line of work.
Yeah. But it wasn't dollars. It was the Crypto Kitty coin. Network is slow right now, so I guess
I can't
afford it because there aren't that many people that are that gullible.
I have not seen a better formed plan for getting people to trade actual money for fake money since like the early 1990s, and when everyone was buying 100 copies of X-Men number one with Jim Lee and those people. That's
Secret Wars 2 number one, Andy. I fell for that hard.
Here's a guy. He's total sales on the CryptoKitties platform, $12 million. Some cats sold for upwards of $80,000. There is a guy who's Todd, a 30-year-old entrepreneur and software designer. He's the owner of 35 CryptoKitties, and he's made more money in CryptoKitties than he has in his investments. His big break came when he purchased an old lace cat for 12 Ether. That was $4,800 at the time of purchase. Later saw the value of the cat rise to 30 Ether. So he's a rich, like, rich man.
So much of this just feels like a Ponzi scheme.
It is a Ponzi scheme.
Tulip economy.
It's like one Ponzi scheme after another, and as long as you get in early, make money on the first Ponzi scheme,
at least
get in early and then sell high.
At least there's some dignity in saying, I lost $130,000 investing in a differential fund that was attached to the GNP. At least those are stuff people don't understand. And, okay, it could have worked. It's like, well, I bought a top hat fuzzy gerbil. And the fuzzy gerbil was supposed to germinate into the wedding veil gerbil. And I would have doubled my money. But I lost $130,000 on the speculating on a wedding veil gerbil, and you feel silly because you are being silly. And
I just sell my house because I bought a kitty.
I bought a kitty,
a real kitty, no, a digital kitty. Can you pet it? No.
So the rumor going around fast and hot and furious today may be debunked by the time you hear this. Exclusive. This is Boy Genius Report. Apple to deploy 1Password, which is a password vault system, very good one, to all 123,000 employees. Acquisition talks underway. Now,
the acquisition talks part has been debunked already.
That's been debunked, right?
Yes.
I wanted to say that. So how was it debunked? Apple said, no, no, no.
No, at 1Password said, no, no, we are staying put. We love our human owners. We're not going anywhere.
Right. We don't need the overlords. However, a great deal for 1Password a big, big deal for 1Password to get 123,000 plus users.
Yeah. There was a lot of confusion because Apple has iCloud Keychain, which with iOS 12 becomes a full password manager because you have everything from a master, quote unquote, master password with Face ID or Touch ID. Plus, you have all the autofill stuff. You have the automatic generation of strong, long passwords, you know, strong, unique passwords. So it is a good starting system. And they're like, why would Apple want to license 1Password? But I think what they get out of this, it's similar to their use of Slack or other small team tools, is that they'll have the ability to collaborate and share passwords across different employees, which iCloud Keychain doesn't provide. Yeah,
that's exactly right. iCloud Keychain is also a fine personal choice, but it is not a good enterprise choice.
Well, and not all their contractors are on iOS or macOS either, so makes sense.
And the one of the big advantages when you're working at an enterprise level is being able to give people passwords they can log into a location but not actually have the password. The fewer number of people that have it, the better. It's not just that you're able to share passwords, but you're able to keep them locked out. When they cease to be an employee, you simply turn it off and they've lost access to all those sites.
Yeah. We, of course, our advertiser is LastPass, which is a direct competitor, 1Password. But it's absolutely the case that you want to use, as we do here at LastPass Enterprise, but you want to use an enterprise version. And 1Password has an enterprise version as well. You want to use an enterprise
Password
version.
Teams.
Yeah.
And does I don't know if what's the built-in Safari, does it do generation of passwords?
Yes. I mean, with iOS 12, it does strong generation.
It doesn't. Okay, you know what? I have to say, I'm really impressed with the iOS 12 on because what happens is it says, do you want me to generate a password? Shows you a nice human readable password, and it automatically saves it. And it saves it to the keychain, right? So it's available now on Mac as well.
Yeah, all your Apple devices. Yeah. It's not good if you have Android phones or Windows phones or Linux, then you want to use LastPass or Dashlane or 1Password because they're cross-platform, and iCloud Keychain very much is not.
Right.
But if you're all in on the Apple ecosystem and you just want a basic password manager, with iOS 12, it is really a good quality, very convenient, very secure one.
And it's on track. I mean, automatically on. You just get it whenever you...
Yeah.
So I think that's really good because, we've been talking a lot about this lately. Megan and I earlier were talking a lot about there's normal users and there's us. And while, you know, you can tell somebody, oh, you have to have a password vault, that's a whole different thing from just making it just pop up. And
an order of magnitude and complexity. And the nice thing about this is that previously it was fine if you used websites, but the minute you went to an app, you had to leave the app, go to your password manager, authenticate, copy the password, go back. And they all tried to make it as easy as possible. But with iOS 12, Apple will also autofill anything from iCloud Keychain into apps as well as websites. And they now have a password manager API, which means if you do use LastPass or Dashlane or 1Password or any of these tools, they can... And they've all said they're doing it. They're going to make it so that you can autofill with your chosen password manager instead, which is nice because sometimes a proprietary solution gets special benefits that the competing third parties don't. But in this case, Apple really wanted to emphasize the security. Yeah. So no matter what you choose, you can't do apps on macOS because there's a level of openness in apps that's different than iOS. But on all your iOS devices, you can autofill right into apps the same way as websites.
Here's the tweet from AgileBits on their 1Password account. Rumors of my acquisition are completely false. My humans and I are happily independent, plan to remain so. I should point out that there could very well be negotiations going on. Mm-hmm. And one of the obligations often in these negotiations is not to say anything.
Deny everything.
And deny everything. Well, and there often are penalties, significant penalties if you don't.
Well, no, that's the difference there is that usually your solution is to not say anything.
Yeah. Not to lie. You wouldn't lie necessarily. Yeah.
Yeah. You're kind of sticking your neck out there. I will say that because that was tweeted by the piece of software, 1Password could have been programmed to say that.
The AI.
Does Apple mention, I think they do, 1Password? They've mentioned them in keynotes, haven't they?
Yeah
I think so.
Yeah.
I think that they are the kind of the quote unquote Apple favorite after LastPass was bought by LogMeIn. It was just it's a different cult. You know,
I have to say,
they like kind of thing. They have a big indie heart.
And 1Password, to be in my experience, to be fair, it really works great on Apple stuff. Is less good on Windows.
Yeah, I mean that's why we chose really LastPass.
LastPass is kind of a better cross platform in my opinion. Again, they're a sponsor. But if you were only using Macs and iOS, 1Password's beautiful. It does a beautiful job of integrating.
It works very well on Android as well. It supports fingerprint recognition. It supports a lot of autofill stuff. It has a couple of tricks, I think, that it can get away with because it's on Android that iOS doesn't support. So, I agree on Windows. Yeah, you need something else to go with. But I've actually standard on 1-1 password myself, even though I really, even though I have a lot more Windows stuff in the office over the past year than I used to. I keep meaning to go to LastPass, but I just like 1Password too much. It's kind of like what you're indicating, that there's some companies that they're not just really, really good Mac and iOS developers. It seems like they've got six color blood. You know, like the yes. like Omni Group, they're a six color company, and 1Password is also a six color company. BB Edit, Bare Bones is a six color company. They're part of the tapestry of Apple, and so there's just something about them that you kind of like.
Agile Bits is very much, you always get the feeling they're very much an Apple house, right?
Yeah.
Did they do anything else? For some reason, I feel like there's other software that was Agile.
No, I mean, I think they always intended to, and they just went. It's like there's a lot of companies who your product becomes so successful, you become synonymous with the product rather than, I think very few people know Agile Bits, but a lot of people know 1Password.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. That's a good, that notice that they tweeted from the 1Password account.
Yeah.
If they tweeted from the Agile Bits account, everybody would say, what?
The other thing that's nice about all this, built into iOS 12 as well, it'll start flagging duplicate passwords for you, which a lot of the big password managers do, but a lot of people just don't even think about that. And there was a time hop breach, for example, this week. And when a company is breached, if you use the same password across many sites, one of the first things hackers do is try the same password on a bunch of important websites.
Huge issue.
So highlighting that you've got repeating passwords and then offering, they make it super easy to go to the website or the app and change your password. The really emphasis is on unique passwords now, but that's not a human solution. So they're not trying.
And as an admin, I believe you can require that too. You can say you can't have, you can push.
Yeah, at least when you're using the team. Yeah, on LastPass, when you're using the team stuff, that is one of the reasons you want to use an enterprise version, is you can have all sorts of requirements. You could say we have to change a password every 3 months. We have to, you have to use two-factor. You can't reuse a password.
And I know
all of those things are huge for teams.
And also for LastPass, we have it log out every time I log in somewhere else.
Yep.
Which is a little annoying when you're trying to do it quickly, but it just means that I always know that it's only open on the device that I'm using today.
There's a race between 1Password and LastPass. Dashlane's kind of secondarily for features and capabilities and security, and that is great.
Yep.
That is great. I did, by the way, we should mention that time hop thing. I hadn't used it, but I had used it for a long time. And time hop at one point had access to all my accounts, because the whole idea of time hop is it would say, here's what you were doing a year ago, 2 years ago, 5 years ago. And so I gave it Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, everything, right? So that breach was potentially significant. I went immediately to my time hop account and couldn't log in because it used a Facebook login, which I don't have. So I don't know how to fix this, but they did say, TimeHop said, we've deactivated all those tokens. So anything that you added as a as an input for TimeHop, you'll have to re-add because of this breach. But that's a significant breach.
Yeah, there was Polar this week as well with the heart rate monitors disclosing.
Yeah, and I have to apologize because Megan and I kind of got into it on Polar. The debate, first of all, Polar did screw up because their API allowed anybody to, because they have sequential serial identifiers for every user, and their API allowed you to just go through the web and sequentially go through every user. So even if a user was private, the location information from their run would be, Polar is a heart rate monitor, and the Polar Flow app is used to track your runs. So even if they had set it to private, that information was exposed. So that's absolutely a leak. But Megan and I were going back and forth on the issue, which was raised by ZDNet and others, and this is the same issue with Strava, that secret facilities could be identified because you can see there were a lot of military folks doing laps around nothing. That was the problem with Strava. And then secondarily, and they were able to demonstrate this, it was a Dutch newspaper that discovered the flaw, you could find an NSA employee, note that he was at the NSA doing stuff at the NSA, and then note where his home was. You could actually figure out what his home address is. That's a huge issue.
I have to admit, there's a little bit of an intelligence test there of having something that tracks your location working at an intelligence
That was
agency.
My contention.
I'm just a little like,
very poor
OPSEC.
Not good craft.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if a spy is doing that, I don't think you can blame Polar for that.
But at the same time, you can blame Polar because
I mean, everybody can be wrong. It's one of those situations where you can have a breach and you can not be using the equipment that can breach.
Yeah,
but it's always the funny thing is it reminds me of my best story I've ever heard about inference based on data, where supposedly the Soviets used to think that there was a really, really important command bunker in the middle of the Pentagon, like in the middle of the courtyard, because they had it wasn't because of fitness trackers. It was because they could see that like they're high level, top level people going in and out of there, and only at certain times of the day. They thought this must be where they're getting
let me guess. Briefings.
It was actually a hot dog stand that was there.
We're getting a hot dog briefing next.
Wasn't there a snack truck story during the Gulf War that was very similar? Everyone thought that was like, and it was really just a snack truck.
However, you know, two things. If you're a spy, if you're working at the NSA, you probably shouldn't be wearing a fitness tracker.
No.
Or maybe even carrying an insecure cell phone.
No.
And you certainly shouldn't take on location sharing. For God's sakes? Well, the president, that's different. He's the president. He can do whatever he wants.
obviously. Clearly. The president agrees with you.
Yes.
His whereabouts are published. You know, for the press. You get that little one sheet that says, this is where he's going to be. Down to like the minute.
Yeah. But if you are a spy, you probably should be a little more cautious than that. And at the same time, yes, Polar definitely screwed up with their API. Because, you know, at this point, there have been so many breaches. Just this week, there were five. It feels like, well, I don't even want to report on them anymore. But I guess we should because, like TimeHop, that could be significant.
There was kind of a funny one today, too, about Apple's new USB disabled mode.
Oh, let's talk let's take a break. And then I do want to talk about that because that's new in 11.4.1, right?
Yes.
And, of course, immediately somebody said, Elcomsoft, which sells hardware that this is supposed to disable, said, oh, no, we can get around that with a simple USB dongle. Let's talk about that in just a second. Yeah. But first, let's talk about brushing your teeth. I know, you don't want to talk about brushing your teeth. You do brush your teeth, don't you? Yeah. if not, I don't want to hang out with you. But I want to tell you about a new way to brush your teeth. It's really great. You know that dentists really recommend these new electric toothbrushes. Absolutely the best. Dentists recommend it. But I've got the best electric toothbrush out there. It's kind of second generation sensible. It's the Quip, Q-U-I-P. Turns out that most of us are not brushing our teeth right. You're not doing it long enough. You're not changing your brush head often enough. And maybe you're doing it by hand. I've been using an electric toothbrush for so long, I forgot how to brush manually. We were on a trip and I didn't have an electric toothbrush. And Lisa and I both are going, what do you do with your wrist? We couldn't figure it out because we're so used to this. But this is our electric toothbrush. Look at this. Looks just like a regular toothbrush. It's tiny. When you travel, it's so great. You travel with it. It comes in a nice little test tube. It doesn't have a charger. You don't have to bring that along. It's powered by a battery, one AAA battery, and that goes for months. So it's a perfect travel toothbrush. It's also great at home because it has a little docking, little holder that has an adhesive on the back. You put it right on your mirror. You'll never forget to brush because it's right there. You're looking right at it. It mounts to your mirror, suctions to your mirror, unsticks to use as a cover for hygienic travel wherever you take your teeth. And I do hope you take your teeth on vacation when you go. Everyone loves Quip. Not just me and Lisa. They were on Oprah's O-List, named one of Time's best inventions of the year, and the first subscription electric toothbrush accepted by the American Dental Association. Quip is backed by a network of over 20,000 dentists and hygienists and hundreds of thousands of happy brushers who Quip every day. Yes, it's got the built-in timer for the dentist recommended 2 minutes, 30 seconds per quadrant with guiding pulses that remind you when to switch. They also, the subscription plan is great. They deliver new brush heads on the dentist recommended schedule every 3 months, just $5, including free shipping worldwide. And right now, when you buy a Quip, you'll get your first refill pack free if you go to getquip.com/twit. Did I tell you $25? $25. They do have some more expensive ones, including the limited edition pink, which is this summer only, so rush on over to getquip.com/twit. But at $25, we bought several because what we do is we have, kids are always sleeping over and they never bring their toothbrush. I wonder why. You'll have this problem soon, Alex. So we just got a couple of quips and a few extra brush heads, put the kid's name on it so that we always have a toothbrush for him. $25, no problem. If you forget and leave it on vacation, $25, you get another one. GetQuip.com/twit to get your first refill pack free when you purchase any Quip electric toothbrush. GetQuip.com/twit. And as I say, they have, you know, different varieties, different models. There's a copper one. We just have the basic ones because they work great. GetQuip.com/twit. All right. In the latest version of iOS, which came out, what, this week, Renee?
Yes.
Recently.
I think yesterday, maybe? Yeah.
There's a new feature that if you don't unlock the phone for an hour, it disables you data access via the Lightning port. Is that correct? Is that how to say it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Immediately, Alcomsoft, which is a company that makes the hardware that this is to block, there are a number of companies, Cellebrite's another one, the Israeli company. Police buy these boxes that they can connect up. They try to unlock your phone, but they can also download the data off of your phone. They can suck the data out of it. And that's exactly, I believe, what Apple's trying to defeat here, right?
Yeah.
Alcomsoft says, oh, no, we can still do it. Of course, remember, they're trying to sell the product that lets them do it. What's the story there?
So this is what they put up was that if you... So Apple has this very clearly on their webpage. They describe what the feature does. And the feature will, after an hour, if everyone has been locked... hasn't been unlocked for an hour, it will shut down access via the Lightning port, the Lightning USB port.
And they call this USB restricted mode.
Yeah, and a design so that if you then go and try and plug in a USB device, you'll have to unlock the iPhone or iPad in order to use it. And it's designed to be exactly what you said, that kind of security feature. But Apple also built in a few exceptions. So, for example, if you use an accessibility accessory in order to enter your passcode, having it lock you out would create an endless loop of despair and frustration. So by default, when you plug one of those in, it will let you use it to enter the passcode. You can turn that off in settings. You can turn it on in settings as well. You can choose to allow that. There are a couple other accessories, like they use the camera kit, which is designed for you to transfer your photos, and Apple prevents it from locking you down because maybe your transfer isn't finished yet. And they immediately called it a bug. It's not a bug. It's as designed. And you could argue with that decision. You could say it should be more secure. It should default to everything off and you should have to go tell it to turn on. Or you could argue that it should be even more convenient, that this should be a feature that you choose to enable and it's never on until you enable it. Or you can choose a balance, which is what Apple did, which is most accessories are locked off, but there are certain accessibility and persistent data transfer accessories that they leave on by default. So if the iPhone is unlocked and they plug in one of these accessories, it will stay unlocked. So they're saying, as soon as you grab the phone, plug in the accessory, plug it into a battery, put it into a Faraday bag, and then, you know, that's it. You're fine.
But once it's locked, what if, so if the... If
so once it's locked, it's still locked.
It still doesn't work.
Yes.
Okay. So this works in a very specific situation. The phone is currently unlocked.
Yes.
You plug in this camera connection kit and start sucking it out. And then why the Faraday bag? So that...
No one can remotely erase the phone.
Ah, because you've got the phone.
Yeah.
So you want to make sure that the erase still works if the phone's on and connected to the internet. So
yes.
You want to make sure it's disconnected from the internet.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I mean, this is what they said is true. The way they decided to tell the story, I have issues with because it's attention getting sensationalism ahead. For this story, what they should have done is looked at the behavior, contacted Apple, said, is this a bug? If it's a bug, you know, we'll work with you to disclose it. If it's not a bug, then you can disclose it immediately and just argue with them that it's not good behavior. That's fine. You can disagree with that behavior. But the way it was presented to me, it was very...
It seems unlikely that Apple would change this, too, because you don't want it to stop the camera connection kit to stop working 10 minutes in because the phone locked itself.
Yeah, people would be frustrated. I mean, that's the thing. Security and convenience, as Steve Gibson always says, they're contentious. They're at war. And some people want you to fail secure and some people want you to fail safe.
Right.
And these are mainstream products and you've got to pick your battles. And maybe they will change it, or maybe the first time you plug it in, they'll say, do you want to let this accessory keep your iPhone unlocked? You know, maybe they'll give you a choice. That introduces complexity. But right now, as designed, this is the way it's supposed
now,
to work.
Now, a good question from the chat room from Out of Sync. Why the 1 hour wait to lock the port? Shouldn't the port just be locked the minute the Lightning port be locked the minute the phone locks?
Again, it's a battle for convenience. If you just lock your phone and you go and plug it in and you come back 8 hours later and it's not charged, you'll be mad.
Oh, so it won't even charge? It's not really data?
There are some accessories that will not charge if you are not unlocked, because some of them are combination data. Okay. Parts. There are some dumb ports that will just charge no matter anything. But like an end user should never have to worry about things like that. You should just, like, your expected behavior is I plug it in, therefore it will charge. And for most people, simple things like that are way more common occurrences than some foreign entity seizing your iPhone and trying to brute force their way into it.
So it needs to be unlocked when you plug the USB in that first
I believe
hour.
So. And you can also choose, if you put it in SOS mode, it locks immediately. So if you're ever worried about your phone, you just pull down the two side buttons, it goes into SOS mode, and then it is back in pre-board. Your keys are thrown away, you have to authenticate to get back in, you can't use Face ID, Touch ID, you can't plug it into USB, nothing. You can do that whenever you want.
So, because that's the curious, like, because it seems like it should, once it's been locked, if you plug it in, it seems like it should just only take power.
It depends on the accessory. There are some accessories that it will still take power from, but some people have accessories that do multiple things, like they plug it into their computer. And even the little pop-up dialog comes up and says, do you want to trust this computer? You may be ignoring that because you just plugged it in and went to bed or something. I would like it to be more secure. I would like them to err more on the side of security, but I feel like I'm a power user who understands those things, and maybe it'd take a lot of explanation to get people to figure out those behavioral patterns.
And what I'm trying to – I was talking about the Scooter X just posted in the IRC, you know. In other words, once the police officer seizes the iPhone, he or she would need to immediately connect the iPhone to
if it's unlocked.
If it's unlocked.
Is your phone unlocked right now?
Never.
Or if it had been unlocked in the last hour.
Is my phone unlocked right now?
That's what I'm saying. It does. I do think that once it's locked, you can't plug something in that would extend that hour, except for power.
You're still running into the accessibility device. Like, accessibility device is designed to let you enter your passcode, and you can't use it because your passcode isn't entered. So they have to build in some exception.
I just feel like if I want to use an accessibility device, I unlock my phone, I plug it in, and then
accessibility device is how you unlock the phone.
But I guess what I would say is that there should be another, like, a very secure mode.
There is a toggle. You can turn that. I believe you can turn that off in settings.
Right, but I'm saying, like, so that basically it is like if it's locked, there's no way. If it's locked, there's no way to plug anything in to extend that time frame. I do think that should be the.
I think that is in settings. I'm double checking now, but I believe it's off by default because they want people to be able to plug it in and then get the pop up that would tell them.
Is this stuff in the security settings? Where is it?
It's in the Face ID and
Face ID, and
Touch ID, Face ID settings. Yeah.
Okay. I think it'd be nice if there were a, like, super secure, like, I don't have any accessibility devices, so I would like to really lock this sucker down. But
USB
I also understand.
USB accessory is mine is off by default.
Yeah. Okay. Once USB, this is Elcom stuff. Once USB restricted mode is engaged in a device, no data communications occur over the Lightning port. A connected computer accessory will not detect a smart device. If anything, an iPhone in USB restricted mode acts as a dumb battery pack. It can be charged, but it cannot be identified as a smart device. And as you point out, Renee, some chargers have to see it as more than just a dumb battery pack. This effectively blocks blocks forensic tools like those made by Elcomsoft from being able to crack passcodes if the phone is more than 1 hour unlocked, 1 hour locked. Grayshift, Cellebrite's tools, these are the ones that Apple's really worried about.
And the article is weird because they talk about they talk about untrusted and trusted accessories, and there's no such thing. There's trusted and untrusted devices because you don't want computers or similar things to do data extraction, but there's no such thing as a trusted or untrusted accessory. Not in this context.
We performed several tests, says Elcomsoft. Actually, in a way, this blog post is reassuring and can now confirm that USB restricted mode is maintained through reboots and persists. Yes. Through software restores via recovery mode. In other words, we found no obvious way to break USB restricted mode. And this is the key. Once it is already engaged. Yep. So the hack they're talking about keeps it from being engaged.
Yes.
We discovered a workaround, which works exactly as we suggested back in May. So it isn't a bug.
But it still sounds like if the police are trained, and let's say that there is a terrorist that they shoot.
No, because they got to seize the device, take it to a lab, then get a search warrant.
Well, so they're suggesting that the police will immediately plug in a camera kit. We'll plug in a camera kit, a battery pack,
just to keep it
on
lock,
and then take it. Yeah.
also, technically, if they killed the guy, they don't need to get a search warrant.
Yep. Okay.
The dead have no privacy rights.
But if they killed the guy, they could just face ID or touch ID it anyway, right away.
In other words, once the police says so
comes
off,
could they do it if it was face ID? Would it work if they were dead?
I mean,
they wouldn't have attention.
A few weeks ago, I had to talk to some people who deal with dead people. They say they have not tested face ID. However, the markers that face ID typically uses should work, given what they were telling me about what the skin does. I was actually looking for the question that you brought up. What are the goalposts you need to fulfill in order to make touch ID work on a dead body? And they were saying minimal handling of the body. They might have to warm and moisturize the finger. If the body has been embalmed already, that's going to be a problem. So they want to get at a fresh corpse, really.
Yes.
There's no thermal measurement, right? Doesn't check to see if the skin's warm.
I thought you need electricity. I mean, there's for the capacitor.
No, for the finger. What about the face ID? Does it measure? No, it does not. It only measures depth, but not heat.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, there were cases too. Like there was a plane last year that was forced to land because a guy fell asleep. His wife put his finger on touch ID, unlocked his phone, saw a bunch of stuff she didn't like, and then there was a ruckus. So, I mean, all of this stuff has edge cases. So
that's why I always give my wife fingerprint access to my phone. In fact, I'm glad iOS 12 will allow – oh, but it doesn't allow me. It allows me to have additional faces but not somebody else's. Yeah,
yeah, an additional appearance but not an additional face.
So I have to give her the password.
Yeah.
That's what, in addition to, as we're having all these discussions, as Apple continues to refine ways of locking down the lockdowns, we need to continue to contemplate different scenarios in which you just want to make sure that you're using unusually high security for certain situations and pretty much free as you go for others. Like, I really wish it were possible to, in settings, select a time period for panic mode. Like how long must I hold down the power button to power down the machine? How long is it going to wait to make sure I actually intend this? How long should I hold a button down in order to turn off touch ID? Because it's going to be hard to, like, you know, to be in the driver's seat of the car and saying, yes, here, let me give you my phone right now. It's going to take me another 8.1 seconds to get from the driver's side here to the window. But there you go. Now take it. So it's weird that 5 years ago when we were contemplating ideas of Touch ID, it used to be things like, I just don't want someone to be guessing my password while I'm walked away from a dinner table. Now it's like, I want to make sure that if I have to go through customs that there's not going to be a someone who has armed with some sort of authority to look through my phone, and I want to have the ability to shut that down if I want to. Like, can you imagine 5 years ago we were thinking about the vulnerability not to snoopers but to the government and to law enforcement?
Yeah.
And so, do keep in mind, the FBI is still on Apple's case about every single technique they do to make it harder for them to get into a phone, even with paperwork. So
I do want to reiterate what Phil Zimmerman, creator of PGP, privacy expert, creator of Black Phone, Silent Circle, told me. He said, there is no question, they call it Zimmerman's Law, there is no question in his mind that technology has made surveillance infinitely easier for law enforcement, that they see a lot more than they ever have seen before. There's cameras everywhere. We all carry devices with microphones on a person. I mean, we're
location trackers.
We're just basically walking bugs. He said, what it is there's no question that they're of going dark. They're not going dark. They see more than ever before. He said what it really is they have this beautiful HD screen that they could see everything. There's a few pixels that are black, and they don't like black pixels because they want to see everything, and that's the phone. And there should be encryption. You got plenty. Yeah.
It's the closest thing we have to cybernetics.
It's not a vague issue. It really is just like, you know, 230 some odd years ago, people who decided the big list of really important rules for the United States decided that free speech was really, really important. The ability to not incriminate yourself, not testify against yourself was important. So they decided to write those things down. Now we're dealing with a whole bunch of situations like, do we have the fundamental right to keep a secret from the government? And that translates into the fight to make sure that private individuals have the right to encrypt their data. And that, again, wasn't discussed 235 years ago, but we're looking for a specific the FBI, the law enforcement, they're not bad people, remember. But I think that when they are making these complaints, they're not talking about seizing someone's phone, taking it back to a squad car and trying to dump as much data as possible. They're usually talking, when they're talking about like the 7,000 devices that they couldn't get into, they're talking about 7,000 devices that they tried to get into after going to the courts, after getting the right warrant, after getting all the paperwork, but they still just technically could not get into this sort of thing. They want to create the legal precedent that law enforcement does have the right to enter the private property of your phone with a proper warrant. And we came really, really close, a 5-4 decision just in the Supreme Court just a couple, 2 or 3 weeks ago, upholding that cell tower data, location data that's being collected from a phone, is protected by the Fourth Amendment. Doesn't matter if they have the right paperwork for it. A citizen is not required to maintain this phone as a tracking device. They have to have a higher level of probable cause in order to get that information from a phone carrier. And once again, that was a decision that had to be made. That was not something that simply was born into human DNA. And that's why anytime someone new comes on the Supreme Court, that's when you have to start thinking about, are we still going to have the right to have a secret from the government in the future? Are they still going to be required to show probable cause before getting this evidence? Or are they going to be held to a lower standard where they don't have to give all this evidence to say, here's why exactly we want to get access to this data collected from this phone, from this person on this date? So it's really going to be difficult, and it's the reason why everyone who's interested in technology should also be interested now in the law and in tech policy.
I think that what I was going to say, I think that when we look at contracts, when we're working on contracts with other companies, we don't assume that it's the people that we're talking to that we're trying to write the contract with, because we like them and we're in a business because we think that they're good people. We're like, if the worst person in the world got a hold of this contract from the other side, like bought their company and took it over, what could they do with this contract? You know, that is what we want to know. And in the same case, you know, we say, well, the government is always looking out for our best interests and it's doing the good thing. We have to look at, you know, I think that when we think about what the government should be doing and shouldn't be doing, we should look back into 30s Germany and 40s Germany and make a decision about, you know, most countries don't span forever where they weren't possibly not great for their citizens. Yep. So I'm not saying that that's happening here, but we need to, when we start thinking about these rules and how they're going to overarch and how they're going to affect us over our lifetimes, we do need to think about what if this country, you know, didn't continue the trajectory that it has and did something, you know, turned south, are we going to be able to protect ourselves?
Should also point out that Supreme Court decision wasn't perhaps as protective as you might think, because Justice Roberts, in writing the decision, said that the issue, he narrowed it, first of all, and he also said the issue was that they collected more than 7 days of data, which gives police information about more than just the crimes, but an intimate window into the person's life. But what he left unsaid was what happens if it's less than 7 days. So a single request for location, for instance, probably isn't covered by this.
It's a really interesting ruling, and it's worth reading the entire thing. One part of the majority opinion was that I think was a big victory, was the acknowledgement that, look, but the founding fathers did not anticipate a device that turns into essentially a wiretap for every. So when we're talking about a collection of data that is where you are at every minute of every single day, this is no normal piece of property. This is something that would give the government an incredible amount of power, and therefore the government should be required to be held to a higher standard of establishing probable cause. And you're right. And they also made sure that we're saying, look, we're only talking about this use of cell phone data, of tower data, getting a warrant for cell phone tower location data from carriers. We're not necessarily talking about the data that's on the phone. We're leaving that alone. But I would say that that was a victory, because they could have said, look, the Fourth Amendment absolutely doesn't apply in this case. A search is a search is a search, no matter what it is. go nuts. And at least we at least can. I hope it doesn't sound cynical that we're that I'm celebrating that we didn't that the barn didn't burn down.
Could have been worse.
Our livestock inside it. Yeah.
Well, I mean, the other thing to remember too is that whatever applies to one country is going to apply to every country, and that's one of the concerns that Apple and other like Microsoft and Google have is that laws enacted in the U.S. will not just be confined to the U.S. And the minute the FBI gets access to phones, China is going to want it, and Russia is going to want it. And countries where they execute people based solely on their opinion or the whims of the dictator du jour are going to demand and have no reason not to expect the exact same access. So when we think about our policies for these things, we've got to do exactly what Alex says, not just what company could do with this contract, but what's the worst thing a government could do with access to this information.
I loved the line in Roberts' majority decision where he says, when the government tracks the location of a cell phone, it achieves near perfect surveillance as if it had attached an ankle monitor to the phone's user.
That's great. Well,
and there was a brief filed by Apple as well as Facebook and Google that said no const- and I think this is probably was persuasive to the judges. No constitutional doctrine should presume that consumers assume the risk of warrantless government surveillance simply by using technologies that are beneficial and increasingly integrated into modern life. That's absolutely true. And I hope that's now we've got a newly reconstituted court, or we'll have some time.
But
in the
Roberts
future,
was the turn on this, so I don't think that would change.
He's the swing vote now. Well, we'll see. We'll see. Kennedy also voted affirmatively. To wrap this up, let me just clarify this. If law enforcement carries a camera connection kit with them at all times, they apprehend somebody, even if the phone's locked, if the guy's unlocked it within less than an hour and they plug in that camera connection kit, and then put it in a bag so he can't erase it, then they will still have unlimited time to access the contents of that phone.
Based on how it operates right now, yeah. Okay. And provided the guy didn't hit SOS mode or otherwise put it into a locked state.
Right.
This is my understanding that I'm saying partly to be helpful and partly so that Renee can shoot me down if I've got it wrong. But I got the impression it's sort of like a severed arm at an accident scene. We're going to throw it in a bucket of ice and transport it. It doesn't mean that you've got the arm reattached, but it means that at least you are preserving the possibility of getting at the data, as opposed to having no possibility of doing it if you delay.
Yeah, the data is encrypted, right? If the phone is locked, the data is encrypted. So then you have that next hurdle. You can get the data off.
I think this wins as being the most gory conversation we've ever had on MacBrain.
Actually, where do we stand on that right now? I've got a I actually have a longer password.
A really long password.
But let's say I have a six-digit code on this. They do that. They arrest me. I unlocked the phone within 59 minutes of the arrest. They immediately plugged in the camera connection kit, took it home, plugged it into a Cellebrite or a Grayshift. What do they get and what can they do with it?
I don't know if it's known right now because Apple fixes things with every updated release, and they've been very coy about whether their software still works. Presume if we go back to the old state, I forget what it was. It was days for 4 weeks for six, and then theoretically the entropy level of the universe if you had 64-digit binary blobs.
So I'm using a, 15-character passphrase. That means it's encrypted, and they can't no tool that they can use. Even though they have the blob, there's no longer any, restriction to them banging on it.
Odds are astronomical. Yeah, I mean, they could always, theoretically put the exact right password in first.
Right.
But the odds of that happening are
astronomical. That's why I don't actually use a numeric passcode. I use an alphanumeric.
Me too.
After one of our discussions, I switched mine to a long, obscure phrase.
Pain in the butt. But
it would take social engineering, in my case, it would be almost impossible social engineering to come up with that phrase.
Right.
Exactly. And last time we were talking about this, I had been talking to some PhD security people there's a couple of people that I know that will talk to me about theoretical things, meaning is this possible? Is this not possible? I mean, if you ask them, is it possible to create a level of encryption so that there is a backdoor that is almost as completely irrationally secure as no backdoor? They will tell me that yes, in theory, but no one has got this working even close yet. But they were telling me, as far as they know, as far as they're aware about how the iPhone works, there's still no way to get to it, to an encrypted phone without a password, and brute forcing is the only way that they know of to get at it. Which doesn't mean that I'm talking to the right people. Doesn't mean that they've signed something that said that we're not going to ever indicate that we found the magic Twinkie that gets us in there. But it's not possible to. The biggest step was simply encrypting the contents of this phone, because before that, you could simply take apart the phone, take out that RAM chip, put it into a new carrier, essentially turn it into a flash drive, and just get the bits off of the actual RAM. But that's, even something that drastic is just not going to work anymore. That's why law enforcement really wants to have this precedent that says that we have the ability, we have the right to have access to a phone if we've established legal right to get access into that thing. And like Renee said, it would be so I'm not saying it would tear down the entire phone industry, but I'm saying it would be so complicated and create such a nest of vipers and worms that only a company the size of Google or Apple could possibly fulfill the needs of law enforcement, not only in the U.S., but across the world, if that were established as something that their phones have to absolutely conform to.
Here's another Apple rumor we can debunk. Apple dropping Intel as radio chip supplier, killing off the product. Intel fires everybody. Oh, no, sorry. That was wrong. So it's very confusing. So this came from CTEH, right? CTEH. Apple will not provide 5G modems. Intel will not provide 5G modems for Apple's 2020 mobile devices, according to internal company communications reviewed by Calculist and people familiar with the matter. So at that point, the team who was working on the product, internally called Sunny Peak, the development was halted. The team was redirected to other efforts. Update. Intel says,
nah.
No, our roadmap has not changed for 2018 through 2020. We remain committed to our 5G plans and projects. So what's going on?
I mean, it's super interesting because, you know, there's a bit of a pylon on Intel right now because they're having such a hard time with process nodes and CPUs, which is usually their strength. But they decided they wanted to get into the modem business. I mean, it's fair. Qualcomm makes both modems and chipsets, so why can't Intel?
And
they
bought Infineon. You may have an Intel radio in your iPhone.
They bought Infineon, which is the first iPhone modem maker. Before Apple even used Qualcomm modems, they used Infineon, and Intel bought them and then re-lobbied for Apple's modem business. And because everybody kind of hates the patent troll disguised as an IP maker, Qualcomm, it is not easy, but it's tempting to do business with almost anybody else. And there's a ton of lawsuits. Qualcomm is suing everybody. Everybody's suing Qualcomm. And there was some theory that maybe just Intel was a casualty of the lawsuit, so they weren't allowed to use the technology that Qualcomm was working on for 5G and thus couldn't supply them. But Intel says that's not the case. And Apple and everybody are apparently – it's hard to talk about 2020 iPhones already, Leo, because we don't even have the 2018 ones.
Right.
But as of right now, they say their plans are unchanged.
Okay.
And also remember that it's only in the past few weeks that they've even locked down the 5G standard. That now it's only in June that everybody like Intel, Qualcomm, everybody that's been making these speculative modem chips that will work with whatever they said 5G was going to be back in December, now they can actually start building stuff as though they're going to actually be able to ship them. So yeah, most carriers are saying that they'll have some sort of 5G product maybe in 2019, and instead of being a phone product, it would be essentially a way of delivering broadband to a house without having to run a cable there. And they're not talking about 5G deployment until 2020. So it's kind of early to say that Apple has decided that they're not going to use Intel anymore, unless they've already decided that they've taken a Pentium processor, wrapped it in fish, sent it to Intel, saying that your platform on Apple sleeps with the fishes, which they haven't done yet, but they might. They might be that spiteful.
And and 5G is going to be a massive investment.
Yeah.
So I think that there's a incredible amount of excitement, within the industry related to how much the people who are making the infrastructure, not the. I mean, I'm sure there's excitement among the people who are going to sell it, like AT&T or Verizon, but the people who are making all the technology, it's a massive outlay. It's the most expensive cellular outlay, information outlay in the history of the world. so it's a big,
no,
it's
exactly.
big business.
It's not just the speed. It's not just taking advantage of existing bands of radio. But in the second wave of 5G devices, when you're talking about latency of something, what 1 millisecond, or is it even
they're talking less than that? one millisecond or less,
right?
And so I don't understand. Like that's outside of my, one of the things that makes it so expensive to roll out is that the transceivers are like I believe that their range is like 250 feet. So it's just an enormous. To get 5G is really going to work mostly in the cities and a little bit in the country and in areas where people choose to do it. But that's going to greatly lower latency, greatly increase the bandwidth, which they may or may not give back to the consumers. That's a big part of net neutrality.
It's not a software upgrade. They can't use existing infrastructure. They have to build an entirely new network to make this work. So if you are unhappy with how you're being billed for broadband now, you're not going to be more happy when 5G rolls out, because they're going to have a lot of expenses to roll out.
Well,
I even talked to one person at a company that I'm not allowed to name, who said that they are intentionally going to be rolling out 5G in smaller areas, specifically because the beamforming that's going to be required to make sure that 5G works in a city, or getting those signals to wrap around buildings and into streets, they know that they can get it in a small city. Like those cities where there is still a law on the books that says, see this church steeple in downtown? No building can be higher than this church steeple. That's going to be the first city to get 5G, whereas New York or LA or San Francisco is going to be later to get it. It's going to be a big, big deal.
Yeah, Stacey Higginbotham told us that she's been looking into this as well. That one of the attributes of 5G is that you need many, many, many more cell towers and backhauls to each of those towers. Because of the beamforming, so there's going to be a lot of hurdles.
It also means that the accuracy of where it knows where you are, which gets back to our earlier conversation, is much, much higher, because you're touching so many transceivers while you're walking.
Right.
They don't know exactly
where you are.
Yeah, but yeah.
At that point, they'll have transceivers and all the money. So
it doesn't really matter.
It's less than 3 feet.
How's your Russian, Andy?
Спасибо.
Can you read this table? Because Apple has filed with the Asian, actually it's Russia, with the Asian Consumer Electronics Commission for 5 new iPad models.
Хорошо,
спасибо. And очень хорошо, 5 new iPad models. Now, this is an April filing, but it's kind of like an FCC filing. It predates.
Yeah.
Now, how's your French, Rene? This was Console Mac that discovered this. De nouveaux iPad et Mac portable en approche are approaching.
Formidable.
Probably in the fall, right?
These things are exactly what you said. They're FCC for the European Eastern European Commission, and that means that Apple has to file them. Not all the products, I believe, that have shown up in these have always shipped.
Oh, so it doesn't mean it'll ship. It just means...
No, but I don't think it can ship without it. So
right. So there's some FUD thrown in, perhaps.
Maybe, or there's just, they don't end up shipping the gold version of the iPhone X, for example. They consolidate on the silver and the space gray, but they want their options open in case they do want to sell it. But this is highly believable to me, because we have the iPad Pro refresh now rumored for September. As far as I know, Intel released the Coffee Lake chips that Apple had been waiting for a couple months ago. Those are the ones that are multi-core, but also have the Iris Pro graphics in them. Because everybody thinks the minute Intel announces Coffee Lake, where's my new MacBook? But Apple uses very specific chips in the MacBook Pros and the iMacs. And also, once they get them, they don't have a lot of faith in Intel anymore, because we've all seen like how Surfaces will melt in people's bags. So they test the bejeebas out of those chips, and they make sure that wake and sleep works, power nap works, all their integration works. And now that they have T chips inside too, the T chips have to handle some things, and the Intel chips have to. So it seems like we're getting to the point where all that has been done. So I think this is probably highly reliable is a wrong word, but I think this is one of the steps we need to see along the way to those things coming out. Yeah.
So there are a 13.3-inch MacBook Pro without touch bar, with touch bar, and a 15.4-inch MacBook Pro. Doesn't look like there's anything for the MacBook Air or MacBook.
I think two of those are Mac.
Are they?
Books. I don't know if the Air is in there.
Maybe this is my French. Que ne correspond ni au MacBook 12 ni au MacBook Air dans leur forme actuelle. Plusieurs rumeurs ont anticipé. Anyway, I don't understand it.
Yeah, so maybe they're not in these codes, but I think.
Maybe not in these codes. Yeah, 1931, 1932, 1988, 1989, and 1990.
I am so not a fan of the Intel Core processors that are included in the MacBook 12-inch that if there is any way Apple could get off. Intel renamed them as iChips, like to try to fool us, but we're not fooled, Intel. Yeah. Fanless is great, but those chips just choke. So I would much rather them get off that platform.
What does Intel call the chip in the new Microsoft Surface?
Pentium Gold.
Gold. It's the Pentium Gold.
All about the Pentiums, baby.
That is the most.
How can we lower the price? Well, we got this fab that we can't.
So the gold is a crap dual core chip. The Pentium Gold processor that is like the Pentium M, right? I mean, it's.
Anthony, got me to go down the rabbit hole of watching all the chip, like the deep chip nerd videos where you watch like a Door TV and all, where they bend them to see what their actual speeds are. Yeah. And you, like, it is such a rabbit hole, but you quickly find out that not all these chips are created equal. Yeah. And they're often, they're often deliberately handicapped. Like, I forget, it was a Core M3 that just Intel basically breaks it.
Right.
So it's not as good as the Core 5.
They have a long history of doing that.
Yeah.
Of making. The Celeron. Well, we'll just disable the L2 cache, and now it's a Celeron.
Yeah, I mean it's weird. I've been I don't have access to the new Surface Go, but I've been looking really hard at the specs, and it seems like a really odd device to make.
Aimed at the iPad, isn't it?
Well, see that's the weird thing. So, again, making this relevant to iPad talk, I don't see anything in here that would make it really competitive with the iPad. Microsoft was talking about how closely they were working with Intel to optimize Microsoft Office apps and Microsoft Suite apps to make sure that it runs very, very nicely on this Pentium Gold processor. And people I know who had chance to get some hands-on say that even intensive apps such as even like the more intensive sort of Office apps seem to work just fine with it. But we're talking about specific apps that were specifically optimized to work on this device. And if you're selling this as what amounts to, frankly, a $500 Windows notebook, by the time you add that really cool keyboard to it, you're going to have a hard time assuring people that third-party Windows apps are going to be responsive or let alone sprightly. And then you're also comparing it to a $500 like Samsung Chromebook, which is a superb five. I mean, if you're talking about best way to spend $500, you've got $500 to spend on a notebook and you want the best thing you can get for that $500, that's hard to surpass that as a recommendation. So you're not really, I don't think they're, I'd be surprised if it's going to outperform a Chromebook, which is just like iOS, another operating system that is really super optimized to be an inexpensive but well-made machine. So it might be they're aiming for the market where they are in a position where they can sell 500 to 1,000 of these to a company at a time just to send out to their salesmen and to their workforce, and it'll work just fine for that. But it doesn't feel like it's a competitor to even the $300 education iPad, which has been able to handle pretty much everything I've thrown at it with the Apple Pencil. So I don't think it's a competition to the iPad. I don't know what it's a competition for.
I'm kind of looking at it thinking I'd like it. I mean, it's running Windows.
It's a full operating
system. You got a pen with it. You got a keyboard. It's the size of an iPad and roughly the price of an iPad. It starts at $399.
And the ergonomics are wonderful. That I wish that the iPad had that really, really great kickstand hinge that Surface models have.
Yes, because it's so variable. Good. So you can have any, not any angle, but you can have a variety of angles, including.
The weird thing for me is still the... The partners, like the OEMs, at a certain point, like you'll make, so don't worry, we're making, like Google and Microsoft, we're making super premium computers to show the future of where this technology can go. We're not really interfering with your business. And then slowly but surely, like the people running all these companies, I don't know what the sign on their forehead says, but Microsoft and Google are both making the most interesting products in the category now. And if I was HP and I was Dell, I would wonder what the deal, like, you know, if Vader was changing the terms of the bargain again.
It kind of cracks me up that they're billing this as a business device. It's clearly a student device, isn't it?
Well, if you're a company and you're buying devices by the hundreds to hand out people that have a very, very predictable brief on what they're going to be using their work computers for, it's not. It doesn't seem ridiculous that they would create a device that costs that. It's a surface grade product in terms of build quality and ergonomics. It costs $500 and will run Microsoft Office as well as anything that costs up to $600 or $700. I could see that, but until I get my hands on one, I don't know if I would counsel anybody to get excited about buying this as a consumer.
I just think that for most people, for regular use, like 90% of the population could use an iPad. You know, I can't. I mean, I use it in specialty areas. And for viewing, watching movies on planes, and I do use it every day, but not like it's my primary, still my Mac. But when I look at other people that are even in our company, there's nothing that they're doing that they couldn't do on an iPad. I mean, and I think that that's the direction that we're going in. I think that we got to this point where people are buying all those cheap computers and they're having trouble buying upgrades because the computer did everything it needed to. You know, Excel ran as fast as it needed to run. And I think that that's the real issue. That's where the growth market is in this. But being able to touch it, and I think that Apple still, like, they missed the boat in subscription with Spotify. They're missing the boat with touchscreen with the laptops. You know, and eventually
the interesting thing too is like again back when the iPad 2 came out, it was mostly my old. They were a whole generation ahead of me, but it was my high school teachers who were all lined up, and it was an entire generation of people for whom computers had always they knew about them, but they were not for them. And these were smart, educated, dialed in, creative, professional people who just never had an affinity for traditional computers from the command line to the GUI. And when they saw an iPad, you could touch it, you could move things around. There was no file system to worry about. And yeah, it was super limited, but for them, that was a feature. And it's sort of grown up with all those people now, but it's still way more approachable whether you're maybe not an infant, but whether you're a child or you're somebody who's in their 80s or 90s trying their first computer. And I think that was sort of the magic moment with iPad. And now we're getting a lot of computers that are becoming more and more accessible, and they're really hitting the mainstream. And computing has gone from this niche thing that only like the nerds and maybe like the scientists and students and enterprise people did. And now everybody has access to really powerful computing technology, not just powerful in terms of chips, but in what it empowers them to do. And that's the part that's got me super excited about all this.
And I do feel like you see this growing. It's like this squeeze where I see people when I'm in the airport, you see people who are, it was like over 60 and under 15. And now it's like under 25 and over 50. And it's like this squeeze of everybody's got iPads. And then there's a couple of us in the middle that are still using our computers.
My mom calls it her computer. She goes, "Where's my computer? Pass me my computer." Right. For her, it's her. And she has an iMac she barely uses anymore just because it's so much more fun and easier and whatever for her to use her iPad anywhere.
Well, I just ordered one. We'll see. Comes August 2nd. So we have a little time before we'll be able to play with it a few weeks.
My biggest question is that there's this thirst in the tech press for different things. Like the BlackBerry Passport comes out and we're like, yes, it's not boring. It's a square. You know, it's amazing. BlackBerry's not afraid to try. And then, it's a failure. And we don't go pay BlackBerry's bills, you know, because of that. And there's like, these companies are being super creative. They can afford to do that because they have a whole OEM market making the workaday computer. So it sort of gives them room to be creative like this. But we applaud and award them, but I still want them to make successful products. So I hope that this is also not just an experiment, but I hope it's a product that's designed to be a hit.
That's why I used to get really, really frustrated when it seemed to be the go-to phrase when someone was writing a hot take on like a non-Apple product. Oh, they just don't get it. They just don't get design. Saying, you know, they get it. They're just in a different business than other people are.
Or it's a killer. It's an Apple killer in the same sentence.
Right. Right, exactly. Like
well, that's how you drive could, traffic. Come
Microsoft
on.
Microsoft can take these Microsoft can afford to take chances because they are selling to they are the world's operating system. They're not just enterprise, they're not just business. They are the computers that everybody by default buys. Which means that they can add they can create their own statement without taking over Dell, without taking over anybody else. Apple has the power to do whatever they want because it's like, well, if you don't like our banana shaped keyboard, there's the door. Go buy anybody else's computer. But if you want it to run Mac OS, you're going to learn to love our banana shaped keyboard. So when you have a company, particularly a smaller one, that's trying to find a way to they can't make a stock boring computer because Dell and HP have got that absolutely locked up. Not meant as an insult. Again, there's most people need boring computers that are affordable and durable. They don't have the R&D or the experience to do something that is hugely innovative because they don't have the money to explain to people how these things work. So I won't say complaining, but at least mentioning that I feel as though in the past 28 years we can come up with something better than a keyboard and a screen separated by a hinge. But when that's all that anybody wants to buy, it's hard to convince people that this new glowing orb is really going to be much better than anything you could even imagine.
If anyone's interested, I had Brian Hall on Vector last month. He was vice president of Surface at Microsoft during all this, and he explains how they did the marketing, how they tried to compete with the MacBook and then tried to compete with the iPad, and sort of why they went after design and the holes they saw in the market and the strategy they came up with. And he's super fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll talk, I'm sure, extensively about Surface Go tomorrow on Windows Weekly, but it is kind of germane to the Apple.
Yeah, it's definitely relevant, but especially with that really wonderful $325 iPad, that is I'm comfortable identifying that as the default iPad for anybody. I still have my iPad Pro, still love my iPad Pro. But if I work my iPad Pro, I have the first generation one, and so I might be attracted to getting a new iPad Pro sometime this year or next year. But I can't absolutely for sure say that if I dropped my iPad and broke the screen, I can't say for sure that I wouldn't just say, why don't I just save $600 and just get a $325 iPad? I'll just max out the RAM because it's so darn fast and it does pretty much everything I want.
So to get back to this leak to the Eurasian Electronics Commission, 9to5 said three of the numbers, 1988, 1989, and 1990, would make sense as new MacBook Pro SKUs. And we have seen, I guess Geekbench has seen some benchmarks that might indicate some
if you were
upgrades.
Apple, wouldn't you blacklist Geekbench at this point? I mean, there's iPhone 11 Geekbench scores. New MacBook.
I know.
Geekbench.
It's pretty amazing. It's a great leak source. It's not completely clear what the new iPad numbers would be, or what their numbers indicate. So, but I would love. I presume we're going to see new iPad. Of some kind, maybe a new iPad Pro. Yeah.
Well, I mean, was it Guillermo? I think Guillermo Rambo found the Animoji interface for the iPad.
Right. So it's got to be true.
Yeah, true depth.
We have birthday cupcakes, not just for Alex Lindsay, but today is the 10th birthday of the Apple App Store, the iPhone App Store.
We were born together. It's us, the App Store, and Nikola Tesla.
Tesla's birthday, too.
I'm pretty sure.
Well, in that case, I'm going to have another cupcake.
Have a cup.
All good things.
I'll have an electric cupcake.
In honor of that birthday, we will sing the first four words of Happy Birthday, which you get for free. If you want to buy a pack of 20 more words, an app purchases of $5.
We already sang it. It's too late. you did the chorus, and I think you did more than 10 words, Andy, so expect a bill. 10th anniversary of the App Store. Anything you want to say about that? That was a big deal. Is it my memory incorrect? Didn't Steve Jobs not want an App Store at first?
So that's an urban myth, and I've talked to a lot of people about it who were actually involved at Apple at the time working on it. And Apple is a platform company, and Apple always wanted iPhone to be a platform. However, it was so hard to get the iPhone to ship by June 2007 that they had zero bandwidth to actually come up with an App Store strategy. And the teams were so exhausted that there was no way they were going to get it done anytime soon. It was going to take a year, maybe more than a year, which is why they tried to do the web app as the suite solution. But then that fell with such a thud, they had to go and say, look, We know you just did a forced march. You just did a marathon of sprints. Can you please pick yourselves up and do it again for next year? And they all just looked at each other and said, we absolutely have to do this. And they had a little debate about whether it should be AppKit or WebKit. And even the WebKit people said, no, it's got to, it can't be WebKit. It's just not there yet for this kind of stuff. You can have web views inside your apps, but you need Cocoa. So they came up with UIKit, and then they busted tail to get that ready for that February event. And I think basically did another forced march for the remaining 9 months and got it done.
Well, it turned out to be a good thing for sure. It's created an entire economy around it, and it's generated a significant amount of revenue for Apple. I don't know how much of the $9.2 billion they made last quarter in services was the App Store, but I have to think it was the lion's share.
A lot. Yeah. And it made apps popular, and it made developers, like, it brought them all into popular culture. Now, it used to be an obscure thing that maybe you got like the Adobe licenses or Microsoft Office at your business, and maybe you got some shareware or freeware, but it wasn't the like movies or music or, you know, even video games. And now it is popular culture, and developers are popular culture. Like, people think about it as a top astronaut, fireman, I want to make an app sort of a thing.
No, it's really true. I get calls all the time on the radio show. I got a brilliant idea for an app. Can you tell me somebody who can write it for me? It's like, dude.
I mean, it's incredible democratization of, you know, even if you think about Flappy Bird.
Kids, 10-year-old.
Is it Flappy Bird?
Flappy Bird, yeah.
That was the poor guy.
Little Vietnamese kid. Teenager.
Was not ready for the... For selling,
couldn't believe he made millions.
Yeah, in a place that you're not supposed to do that.
I meet 10, 11, 12-year-olds all the time who want to write, and some are actually writing, and some have even published apps in the App Store. That's a great thing.
And the fact that it's so inexpensive and it's so easy, and you really can build a business around it. It's almost like the next generation of delivery.
I wonder, though, how many app developers make money.
A lot of businesses don't make money either. I mean, like, you know, most restaurants go under, most other, you know, there's...
Is it harder to make a success in the App Store than it is as a...
As a restaurant owner, it is much much less expensive than a restaurant to get started. Yeah. And you're only dealing with yourself.
I mean, your spare time.
The risk is a lot lower.
There's definitely plenty of people who fail at it. And then they say, oh, well, you can't make any money on the App Store. But then there's all these people that, you know, it doesn't mean that you can just put it up on the App Store and expect everyone to use it. You still have to think about BR.
It has to be great.
You still have to have...
has to be great.
Yeah, it has to be. And that's the thing, is that the UI, the user experience on an iOS app has to be very good. I think that unless you do something really obscure, you cannot have anything that's hokey. Because I know as a user, I pick it up, oh, this is hokey. You know, like, and I just stop using it almost immediately just over the design. You know, unless something is... you know, that, so you still have to think about that process. And I think that a lot of people don't. They just throw it up there and go, well, no one bought it. Well, yeah, there had to have been some work around that, you know, to make it work. But I will say the other thing that people, I've talked to a couple of folks that getting recommended on the by Apple.
That helps.
It's like literally some of them have retired on that, just on a recommendation. I mean, a well-built app and then showing up on the front page is... there was someone I knew, I'll not make it specific, but that their app was featured in one of the ads, and they just said it was stunning. It was in a week, there's not that many other places in the world other than sports, which is just as random, you know, that you could make that much money that quickly. You know,
there was a couple articles about the Trism guy and Twitter, Tweety guy, like Lauren Brichter, and I forget the Trism guy, but how much they were making at the height of the App Store, and it was ludicrous numbers.
Yeah, yeah.
But that is such an apt analogy, though. It's like there are people who can start with nothing and by the age of 18 be signed to a 5-year NBA contract worth $10 million a year. And that's what gets all of these kids like neglecting their studies to make sure that they become really good at basketball, because they don't imagine themselves being one of the 92.8% of aspirants who blow out a knee at age 14.
Yeah, but the difference is, though, of course, the difference is that when you turn 18 and you don't get signed, all you know how to do is play basketball. You know, when you turn 18 and you don't get signed for this, you know how to program.
You can code.
You know, that was a really good skill. It's a skill that almost everybody wants. So it's not a bad thing. I'm trying to slowly pull my kids into programming just so that they,
Because you don't want to work
Swift? Would you teach him Swift?
I know that's all I'm teaching him.
Got a Swift. Got
to
Swift.
I'm not even – well, I mean that and a variety of coding for Arduino and you know that kind of thing. So it's, you know, it's a little bit of mixture. The idea of thinking about it – at first, I don't want them thinking about they could get a job or anything else. I just want them to see that – using
it's fun.
Electronics and coding
it's
is just
fun.
It's just to fix things. Like that's why we were talking about like how to water the plants or how to do these other things. It's just how to fix things. Like
I think if you're going to succeed as a coder, you got to actually enjoy it.
I learned how to code because I was I was tired of rolling dice for Dungeons and Dragons.
That's a great reason.
My first app was something just created non-player characters because I was a dungeon master and I was like this is taking forever to build all these non-player characters.
That's actually really good incentive. Yeah,
you know and. So that was my impetus, and then I did rocket trajectories, which is much more interesting. Learned a lot more.
Yeah, that's why I don't like when people show me curricula for learning for programming. I'm always kind of bummed out when it really is more like we're going to teach you how to do math. Like, no, that's not how programming works. Just we give kids paper and crayons and tell them to draw whatever they want. We don't teach them all about the history of the crayon. We don't tell them about how varying pressure can create varying lines. The way to teach programming is to say what kind of app is not out there yet, but you'd love to have. And it doesn't have to be. We're not talking about making success in the app store. It's like for you, little Alex. What is the little Alex app? So I want one so that every time I have a piece of gum, I can keep track of what kind of piece of gum I had and how it lasted. Great. So we're gonna for the next 4 weeks we're gonna build a little Alex's piece of gum. How long did that last app? And that's how you learn step by step by step.
Right.
That really is the way to go. But one thing I really wanted to respond to though is that I don't think we should give all the credit to the App Store. I think there's a three-legged stool here that the App Store would not have had. You need the App Store. You need a powerful mobile device, and you need mobile broadband. It wasn't with any one of these three legs of the stool missing.
I agree.
Neither of them would have been quite so good. We had mobile apps and stores where you could get mobile apps, but we didn't have an internet and we didn't have something as well done as the App Store. And it wasn't just the App Store. It was that someone decides to write an Instagram app that can suddenly take this. You're no longer taking your phone home and syncing these wonderful 2 megapixel images and then emailing them to people on AOL. You are basically saying, hey, here I am. Here's my food. Here's the person who was mean to me at the parking lot. And that's what gets people to the App Store to find out what the next app they want to get is. So
Renee, did you get the poster? I wanted this poster.
No, I didn't.
Oh, well, wait a minute. This is for the 5 years of the App Store.
Yeah.
I want the 10-year poster.
I mean, I had a bunch of phones before the iPhone, mostly Trios. I had some Windows mobile devices.
Trio was
you there was no singular app store. I had to go to like Palm Info Center.
There was a BlackBerry. There was a BlackBerry app store.
Well, there was a CrackBerry store, but there was no App World until BlackBerry 10 came out.
Oh, really? Okay.
Which was great for CrackBerry at the time, but I mean, it wasn't. And I would buy them from many places. I'd forget where they were. Each one had a different licensing scheme. Some of them were incredibly onerous. They were super expensive. Like it was $40 for the yellow sticky notes app and $40 for IM Plus, and they were hard to install. They would crash the phone. Like the phone call would come in, and the app would crash the entire phone while I was trying to. And it was such a different world. And when that app store got put on there and it was secure and you didn't have to worry about it. And I had a bunch of developer friends who were writing the Windows mobile and Palm apps. And they're just like, there is no amount of money that we could pay that is worth the amount of trust that just goes into people going there, pressing the button and buying your app. And that was like the biggest thing for them was that they could make software that for the first time was really mainstream. It was so expensive to get boxes and shrink wrap and be in the big buy stores or create our own website and do all these things. And we sort of take it for granted now that at any time we hit that little icon and it gives birth to a million other little icons on our phone and we don't even have to think about it anymore.
Well,
I've been to Bare Bones Software's offices back in the day. They needed offices because they were doing things mail order. They needed a room where they could pay people to pack boxes and put T-shirts and manuals in boxes. And the internet really changed all of that. And it wasn't just for the users having this one place to come to find where all the apps are going to be and do a search for them. It's also your you're a developer, you're a programmer, you're really good at programming, and you think that you've got this Outliner app that's actually very useful and very saleable. Now, do you release it as freeware? Because and then say, everybody have at it, it's wonderful, enjoy it, I'll take my pleasure at the fact that you people enjoy it. Or are you going to incorporate and then figure out how to take credit card transactions and open a business account at your local bank and get a lawyer to incorporate? That was part of the problem. That was part of the reasons why great apps weren't going to be turned into commercial products. But the ability to fill out a few online forms and just simply say, I don't care that you're taking 30 cents out of every dollar. I'm not even going to break it down to see if I can get a better deal elsewhere. If I can get a deal where all I do is I send you my package and then you simply send me a check from time to time reflecting the amount of sales that I got, I'm good. That's what brought people.
And when we had an app, I mean, we had this green screen removal app, DB Mat, and
that was a desktop app.
The desktop app. It was a plugin for Final Cut, and it made a lot of money. I mean, it wasn't but it was all electronic. The first thing we did was training, which was on CDs on Photoshop, and we developed this long 70,000 mailing list because of
MacBreak Weekly.
No, screensavers.
Screensavers.
Because I would be on every...
Well, congratulations.
That was the whole model, Leo. so anyway, because I'd always go, we didn't have enough time.
I was wondering why you keep showing up.
Every week, what I would do is go, we didn't have enough time to really show this. So there's a video and a little tutorial. And I worked all day on... So I would spend basically 2 days of my life
That's just awesome.
Screensavers every week. Because the first day I would figure it out and figure out how to do it quickly. Then I'd build literally a PDF of how to do whatever I was going to show on screensavers. Then I would have a little movie on how to do it.
So funny.
And then I would
Learning this now, 20 years later.
So it was like 2 days of, and then I would show up like I just came up with this thing, you know, and then I got an idea. Let's do this thing. And then what happened was you go to our website and it would put you behind, it was behind an email, give us your email and we'll let you down, watch a 20-minute version of what I did in 7 minutes. And there's a PDF of literally step-by-step that I painstakingly put through and tested.
You know what? I wish more of our guests had done that because that's hugely valuable.
Well, and
Bert Monroy would come on. Happy birthday, right. By the way, 70 years old. Bert Monroy would come on and go, and you got a brick wall. And I was always saying, Bert, could you please tell us how to do that?
Right. So, and I would get 1,000 new emails a week, nice. Of the stuff. And so after a year or so,
70,000 emails
later. So I put out an email. I was like, people kept on saying, can you do Photoshop training? And I was like, there are books. There's a whole section in Borders Bookstore and everything else. No, we want you to do it. So I announced that, hey, I'm doing it. And if you buy it right now, it's cheaper, $35 or something for the disc. And I figured it would sell a couple hundred. Yeah, we sold 2,000 in the first day. And they're on disc. And so we had to buy a disc. Printer and a thing and a thing and a thing like we were
it
we
really
had no
is easier
plan
now, isn't it?
Yeah. But nowadays it would have just been you can just go there and download it with with the other problem we have on our app. We got smart, there's no disc, you could only download it, but it was I didn't put any copyright, we never told anyone, but we had a little installer but we never had any copy protection at all. Like we just didn't, it was just like I don't want to spend money on it, and we figured someone will break it anyway, so why bother putting it in, And so we just sold this thing that had no copy protection, and it was $128,000, but it was still like we had to pay someone for managing our e-commerce, and then we didn't have any protection. Now you have this incredible opportunity where it's copy, because it's cheap, because it's so protected within the ecosystem. The prices for us as consumers goes down because I don't have to account for all the people stealing it, and there's, so I can sell it for $5 or $10 or $15 instead of when you bought it before, the legal people were paying $75 or $100 because there were thousands of people that were, for every one person that was paying for it, there was 100 people who weren't. That was the issue.
Instagram leaps to mind. Without the App Store, there would be no Instagram, which ended up selling to Facebook for $1 billion.
Arguably Uber.
Uber.
Without
a phone app, there is no Uber.
Totally. And one of the things that, you can make a lot of arguments about good choices and bad choices that Apple has made, but one of the biggest gripes is that Apple has been way too restrictive. But then you look at more open app stores, and there's really no compelling apps that have done anything beyond what you can do in the App Store. And in fact, most of the compelling apps are available on every platform now, and have really, they've changed logistics, and they've changed commerce, and they've changed communication, just messaging and social networks and all of these things. Facebook and Twitter came alive because of mobile, being
absolutely.
Primarily
Twitter
a mobile
makes
first
no
device.
Sense without an app.
Neither Spotify, neither this.
Remember, Twitter started as text messaging, so.
Yeah, but I mean, that very quickly, it outgrew that very quickly. If you ever use Twitter as a text messaging platform, you realize getting all those messages was a bad idea.
Like Joe Hewitt's first Facebook app, too. I mean, that was transformative for them.
Facebook was huge. In fact, Facebook is the, according to App Annie, the number one most downloaded.
Do you remember when Facebook came out with an app? I was like, I don't even want to bother.
It was a terrible
app. Like, it was like, oh, this is stupid. I'm just going to go back to, you know. But
they made that special framework. I forget what it was called, but everyone used it for
React.
A long time. Actually, before that, it was a web app to.
That was their mistake, and they even admitted that. They said, you know, we just made it a website on app. Right. And the irony of all this is we're going back to website apps with progressive web apps, and Apple's going to support it. And so you're going to get to now, you know, soon you'll be going to websites. It'll say, would you like to download? Would you like to put this on the homepage? And it's offline app.
We went from Java to Air to Electron to progressive web apps.
Yeah.
There's always going to be some commodity cross-platform framework.
Yeah. It is, and that's a good way to put it, a commodity. Yelp, Airbnb.
Yeah.
I could think of a lot of apps that businesses that wouldn't exist without apps.
We were just talking about it, Pokemon Go. You have to have location and screen and data you know, all these things.
And you can say now, well, now that Android has come along and had an app store too that – they certainly are a big part of the ecosystem these days, but Apple started it all.
Yeah.
The idea of putting it in the center.
And not only that, but the idea of having a completely multi-touch interface without any hard locked buttons or clicky buttons on there. So basically the ability to create an interface that's optimized for this specific task and nothing else, that ushered in such wonderful flexibility and creativity for people where you don't have to, when there's always a clicky QWERTY keyboard staring you in the face, there's always going to be the impulse to use that clicky keyboard, as opposed to realizing that the point of this app is not for people to be looking at a keyboard, but to be looking at data. So we're going to keep that keyboard out of the way. We could have a long 2-hour special about every single app store the app store on Google and the app store on Apple and every single piece of technology that both required it and both was that the app store was enhanced by. It really is. It's part of the glue that holds together so much of the world today.
Apple talks about Emoji, a name you may not know, but the company that created Temple Run. And, I'm sorry, Ken Shepard and Natalia Lukyanova of Emoji Studios. Temple Run, I didn't know this, has been downloaded over 1 billion times. Without the App Store, you can't think of an application that's been installed 1 billion times. Maybe Microsoft Office. I mean, that's mind-boggling.
Because they made it so easy.
It's easy.
You know, you can talk about the pricing too, but in the old days, you would maybe buy 2 or 3 apps a year. Most people, maybe not even that. And now people want to download 3-4 a day sometimes, 3-4 a week. Yeah. The entire scale is drastically changed.
And apps like Fortnite, which of course started on the desktop, do so well. Fortnite's now making, $150 million a day? Apple?
And we've grown from this idea of, like, how do we do demos? So people have gotten really good at, I'm going to give you a free one, and then you can, and the in-app purchase kind of revolutionized a lot of that, where I can, you know, you'll download it, you'll play with it, you get a feel for it, and you hit a button, and you pay for the pro version, and otherwise you still got some stuff you can do. And I think that has made it super easy for people to just kind of experiment and buy, and the fact that it's $2.99 or $1.99 or whatever.
The amazing thing is 10 years later, we're now redefining what an app is, because previously it was a binary bundle, and now Apple has extensibility, Google has slices. Soon you're going to be using your voice to just trigger a workflow that'll have apps involved, but you may not even really realize they're doing anything. And it's like when websites became web APIs and you just access them from everywhere, apps are becoming broken down into their actions, into their features, and we're putting them together in new and amazing ways. And what apps are we going to have in 10 years? I can't even imagine how far along we'll be now.
We won't think. Just like we're starting to stop thinking about files now, I think we're going to be stopping thinking about apps at all in the next 5 years, which will make it easier to which will make it easier for the App Store to have its ultimate expression of its primary destructive power, which is to make sure we grind away consumers' expectation that any app should cost really anything at all. The only bad thing about the App Store, I think, is that it really has gotten people to feel so entitled that, oh my God, you need that all it does is like, it's just a word processor and a presentation tool and an art program and has all the knowledge of the entire world in 8 seconds, and you want $5 for it? Should be free, one star.
I mean, the web did that for like content. Like, you used to be able to charge for content, and now nobody wants to pay anything for content. And Netflix, I think, has done that for like, well, I'm not going to buy an iTunes movie for $20. Are you people high? It's free on Netflix.
That's different, because most people, how many movies or TV shows do you love enough that you want to own it? And so you want to be able to see it 5 years
from now. Andy.
Okay, true. That's true. Says to the man who has 18 to this fourth power of watch bands.
The music industry complains about that too. Like, we've Spotify and Apple Music have now, like, when you get to scale, there the scarcity disappears, and it making digital copies is, you know, it's bits, and we start to redefine what value is, and it sucks for the people who create this stuff. But we haven't really found a way to fix that, I think, across any media type yet.
It really sucks for the people who built their businesses based on a successful model that worked for far too many years to allow them to imagine it working elsewhere.
Yeah.
I mean, just today, I bought last week I bought at the Goodwill for $2 the 2 CD original Broadway soundtrack of Ain't Misbehavin' and Katie Lang's first CD. And I don't know how many times that music has been passing through people's hands over the past 20 years or so. But the record company, they got their first $13, and that was it. Imagine someone who is building a new music company, or a little bit more visionary, or excuse me, a little. They're not so focused on the money they're losing by no longer being able to sell $14 albums. Imagine other executives who are able to say, "But what if they just keep giving us money every single month and they never actually own anything? That if they want to, if this person wants, yes, we're going to lose on the back end. We're not getting $14 for this Katie Lang album, but over the next 10 years, we will get like $40 out of this person out of plays if he actually keeps playing it. So you never know. There's a line from The Godfather I keep coming back to, which is, sometimes these things, they just got to happen every 10 years or so. It gets rid of the bad blood, which is not to be glib about an entire industry being crushed, he said, as a former newspaper writer.
Yeah.
But every 10 years or so, these things have to happen. It's almost impossible for an existing entrenched business to morph, to change, to become something completely else, because everybody who's at that company didn't grow up in a world where you have a phone in your hand that is a full working computer with instant access to the internet all the time. You can't really think about how to build a product that really suits that device and really suits the individual using it. So it's tough, but it's a rare bird that can figure out how to be making typewriters in 1977, but how to make wristwatches that are digital and have internet connectivity in 2018.
Let's take a little break, because it's time for our picks of the week. And while you get ready for that, we need to make a little coffee to go with our cupcakes.
Yes.
I think we should get a little something from Tres Pontas. We had some Brazilians in the other day, and they said you pronounce it Tres Pontas, from Tres Pontas. But if I say that, you won't know how to spell it. So I'm going to say Tres Pontas, Tres Pontas. This is single family farm in Brazil, the Race family coffee farm. It's near the town of Tres Pontas in Brazil. It is a famous mountain range for growing some of the best coffee ever in the world. The Race family's been there for three generations, over 100 years, and this is the first time they've ever exported their coffee to the U.S. Here's your chance to try the best. Every bag is roasted. By the way, they ship the beans green to the U.S. and roast them here so that you get them fresh from the U.S. In fact, every bag has a roast date. This one roasted for us July 2nd. We got it a few days ago. That's how quickly they turn it around. It may still be warm. And every bag also has something else, which I really love. On the back, we could just do this real quickly here. It's got a QR code on the back, which you can scan. And you see, I'm now going to be able to open the Google Maps. And it's going to say exactly where this coffee came from. Look at that. Minas Gerais. There's the bean. I think that's the bean right there. If I zoom in, that's the one, right? Isn't that fun to see where your coffee's from? Oh, smell it too, by the way. Whole bean coffee, or You can get it ground, but I would suggest get whole bean coffee. It's 100% Arabica beans, certified non-GMO, certified kosher. This is kind of taking fair trade to the next level, buying directly from the farmer. They're picked by hand, roasted by hand in small batches. And by the way, this coffee, because it's grown high in the mountains, is pulped natural. That is not washed. And you actually want the pulp to stay on the beans because that keeps the coffee smooth. If you've been buying coffee from other regions that is, there it is, there's the farm, that is bitter, it's because they're washed. These beans don't need to be. They're pulped natural. Get freshly roasted beans sent to you every 1, 2, or 4 weeks. 12-ounce bags. I like the slightly smaller bag because that way you can get it more often and it'll be fresh. And by the way, fresher is better. They do light, medium, dark, or French roast. If you really want to taste the bean, I actually do get French roast because I like to espresso it. But if you really want to taste the bean, get medium, at least one bag of medium once in a while, and brew it in a, we use the AeroPress. When you brew it in AeroPress with a burr grinder, freshly ground, and you brew it, that is a taste you will never forget. But be prepared, you'll never enjoy coffee from other places again. You're going to always want Tres Puntas. Now, we have a very, I forgot to mention one more thing. In fact, they've been selling this like crazy. They also grow olives there. And we only now at home use Tres Puntas olive oil. Extra virgin, cold pressed. It's hand-picked in the beautiful Casablanca Valley of Brazil. Single farm olive oil. And it is, I'm going to open it up. Because you can actually, it's so good, you actually put a little on your finger and taste it. You'll oh man. Oh, it's like you're going, to the farm. It's smooth, it's not bitter. You know, you could dip a little bread in that. It would be the best thing. Yeah. Isn't that good?
Really good.
Here, it's yours. Take it with you. I'm giving you a bottle. Annie and so Renee will send you some if you want. It is the best olive oil.
A good olive oil is like the easiest way to trick people into thinking you are a wonderful cook.
It's a nectar.
You just drizzle some really good olive oil as a finish over whatever you're making, and they look, oh my God, what did you do to this?
And
this,
I was just looking for some. So
were you? Perfect. So sometimes olive oil can be a little bitter.
Yep.
This is so smooth and sweet and delicious. It's really amazing. So here's the deal. For the coffee. I don't think I have an olive oil deal for you. But you can go to the website and look at the olive oil. Tres Puntas, T-R-E-S-P-O-N-T-A-S, T-A-S, like Ponto Puntas, trespuntas.com/MacBreak. Normally, you're going to get 10% off because you subscribe, right? We're going to give you an additional 10% when you use the code MacBreak. That's 20% off. And it's not just for the first bag. That's forever. So you really want to do this subscription. I know, okay, maybe you say, well, can I taste it first? You can order a bag and you won't get the discount, but you can taste it first. But then do the subscription because that's when you get the really good, 20% off. Come on. trespuntas.com/MacBreak. Use the code MacBreak. Pick up some olive oil, too, while you're there.
Which bone?
Is that Portuguese?
Brazilian Portuguese for very good.
Oh. Yeah,
mas inteligente.
Oh, gracias.
Mas forte.
Yeah, it's so...
I thought you only knew the fighting words in Portuguese.
Oh, that's right. You're a Brazilian jiu-jitsu.
I'm trying to cobble together what got yelled at me over the last few years.
I've heard that they have very liberal residency requirements in Portugal, but you have to speak a little Portuguese.
Noted. I hear it's just beautiful.
It's
amazing.
Beautiful. Food's great. You're a member of the EU, so you can travel freely within the EU.
Mm.
You could live anywhere in the EU, too.
And eat all the bacalao you want.
Eat all the bacalao you want, which is not much. But if you retire
What about feijoada, Leo? Can you eat feijoada?
I'll eat all of that, or the probleta. But if you travel there, if you move there as a retiree, they have some sort of deal tax-free for the first 10 years. I'll be dead after that. So that's a good deal.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, Portugal. Learn some Portuguese. Start by getting Tres Puntas coffee. Rene Ritchie, your pick of the week.
So when I was at WWDC, my long-serving wallet disintegrated, and I needed to find a replacement.
No.
So I decided to go for the trendy Ridge wallet.
And went metal. I'm really curious in this. Tell us about this.
I wasn't sure because part of me wanted to get the carbon fiber one just because I could wear it through airport security. Well, theoretically wear it through airport security. But I ended up getting, it just looked so cool, titanium, and I have a fondness for titanium MacBooks going back a long time. And it's really cool. It's very low key. It's very stealth. It'll block RFID. So if someone's trying to pull off the chip data from your, you know, if they're trying to snoop you for a little bit of data off of your cards, it blocks all that. But I've always liked the sort of combo card money clip design. I just had it in leather before and it didn't last very long. So I figured this will last for a long time. And it was, I'd seen a couple of them. A couple of people had them that I knew were really happy with them. So I thought, you know, it looks cool. It works. It so far it's worked really, really well. And I'm hoping it is.
This is my concern, having a metal object in your pocket.
No, I guess security scanners were the only thing that gave me some hesitation, but I figure I take my laptop and my phone out anyway.
I always take my wallet out and go through the scanner. I never put my wallet through the scanner anyway. I always put it in a little, you know, round dish that they have with your keys and your wallet. So that doesn't work. But I mean, the comfort-wise,
it's so small. You barely. I mean, I have the kind of the Jim Dalrymple pants where you could probably put an iPad Mini in the back pocket. It has been
so it's the size of a credit card.
Yeah, it's just a little, and you could put as many cards or as few as you want.
Oh, look at that.
Yeah, it's elastic, so it just expires. And all you do is you push up on the bottom, the cards come out. You can pinch it so that they fan, and then you just pull out the card that you want.
I drop cards all the time by accident. Is it pretty good at the grip on the card there?
I have not dropped a single card. And my old one, because it was leather, it just stretched.
Yeah.
And I don't know if the elastics will stretch on this, but I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful, at least, Leo.
Which one did you get? Did you get the burnt titanium?
Yes. Yeah, because it just sounded dope. It sounded so cool.
It looks kind of dope.
Yeah. And the carbon fiber was really appealing, and I might end up switching to that. I thought this might be too heavy, but it hasn't been. And it's got a nice weight if I ever have to throw it at somebody and run real fast.
But the carbon fiber is lighter.
Yeah.
And, of course, doesn't set off a metal detector.
Yeah. So if you're Wolverine, you're setting it off anyway, but for the rest of us, maybe.
Adamantium is a bad thing to have in your body.
Depends who's after you.
Yeah, you don't even want to see my wallet.
Do you have a George Costanza wallet?
I have a Costanza.
And you're just trying to fit that last fortune?
Well, and what I've been doing is carrying like a minimalistic number of cards, like my driver's license and like one credit card and $100 bill in case I get lost. In my phone.
If found, please send back to Lisa.
That's all I use is the
yeah, but you can't carry. I can't carry any much cash because it gets too fat.
I've heard of this thing called cash.
Yeah, you know,
it was used
cash
in the last century.
I have a conventional wallet, and one of the reasons why I selected this one and not another one is that it does have like a tiny little like purse on one side of it because I do need to carry one SD card and a SIM extraction tool because the number of times where I've left the house and only when I'm on like the commuter rail train realized, oh, remember how you took pictures over the weekend and you took the card out of this camera and put it into the laptop and you never took it out of the laptop and put it back in the camera? Oh, good. At least I have I'll have an emergency SD card. And the only time I can find
extraction tool. I have so much crap. I have two zippered pouches in my wallet. It's so fat I have to have a little snap to snap it together. Sorry, three zippered pouches. That's where I keep the big books.
That is a lot of...
This is ridiculous to carry this around in your pocket.
It's a lot of functionality.
It's heavy functionality, but you're right, Andy. It's
bad for your back.
Bad for your back. Oh, Andy's getting his wallet. Let's compare wallets.
Okay, yes, mine is... But look.
Oh, that's a Costanza.
That's a Costanza.
Okay, but this also can in my defense, this also has like my Moo cards in it, the business cards from an event I went to a while ago. Yeah, I haven't cleaned it out well.
It's a wallet of holding.
I'm not lying. Here is it needs to be. I need to have that little purse.
I got that too. Yeah, little side thing.
There you go. Okay, yes, it is like a purse. Now I've got four SD. I'm not joking.
That's cuckoo.
Also an LED light, USB light.
I have a few of those.
SIM extraction tool, which is quite important.
You guys gonna have that's on my keychain on that one. Yeah.
And 128 gigabytes of USB storage.
Very handy. You never know.
I will tell you the number of times where I've been in a situation away from the office, like, oh man, I'm totally screwed. Oh wait a minute. I think I might. Did I still have 128 gigabytes of storage? Yes, I do. But yes, I can.
All right. So Ridge, I have to try the Ridge. I don't know if you could turn this into a Ridge wallet, but I'm going to try. So you put the cash in the clip.
Yeah, I ran out because the local ice cream store finally reopened and they only took cash. So I emptied this out. But I just put the cash there in the little clip. It works great.
I might be picking one up. I have a wallet fetish.
I know, right? I bought this right after I ordered the one that fits your whole passport in it.
Yeah. I have that too.
I know, right?
In fact, when I travel, I have a giant wallet because it's got a passport in it. And it's got a number of slots for different currencies. And it's got a pen in it so you could fill out the customs form.
But they don't have customs forms. I have Nexus, and we don't need customs
it's
forms
all digital
anymore.
Now.
I'll say the only time that I feel like Jason Bourne is when I empty out my wallet and clean it out and realize that I have functioning transit system cards for 4 U.S. cities and 2 international cities. It's not 6 different identity cards, but if I ever go back to London...
Andy, what's your pick of the week?
Since we're on fashion with wallets, this is something that I've been holding off on recommending to make sure they actually liked it. This is a pair of shoes I got about a month ago called the Zero, X-E-R-O.
Ooh.
And this is technically called a minimal like sneaker. And it's called so because... it's not like one of those shoes where it's like just like a glove and you have individual toe capsules that make you look horrible, but it is just a layer of canvas and a thin like layer of rubber on the bottom there. And the idea being that it's the design goal is to make it as close to walking around barefoot as possible. I'll talk about it from two different perspectives. One perspective being the one that it was meant to serve. And I'll say it really is kind of cool to be like walking around in the neighborhood and you can feel the cracks in the sidewalk and you can feel like the textures of things you're walking on. Your feet aren't like conforming to what your shoe is doing. But nonetheless, your feet are comfortable and they're being protected. And they're also comfortable enough that I was at a 2-day street fair over the weekend, and I just I'll just wear these to see how well they work, and they were completely comfortable. My feet weren't sore at all. They people who make shoes like these will tell you that you see the problem. The reason why people have like foot and leg and back problems is because their shoes are trying to make. We were born to walk barefoot, and when things go off kilter when we're not walking barefoot. I don't know anything about that, but they are really really comfortable. The other reasons that I bought them are one because. Sometimes I want to wear like really if they're really good for travel because they can just like squash into nothing. And so you can have like an extra pair of shoes like in your bag because they're basically the size of a pair of slippers. But the other one is I think they're really good freelancer shoes because
well, I need those.
Like, yeah. I mean, I'm in the habit if like a day like today, I'm going to be in the office all day. And so, yes, I still shower. I still shave. I still put on clean clothes, but I might not wear shoes like for 30 hours. And I will say that leads to a certain lack of professionalism. I feel as though if I actually have shoes on my feet, then I feel like I'm being a little bit more professional. And also, like if I have to answer the door to sign for a package or to talk to a neighbor or go downstairs to pick up my mail, I don't feel like some sort of hillbilly who doesn't own a pair of shoes. So these are really they're like formal slippers. They're like structured slippers almost. And yeah, they're I've had it for about a month. They were kind of weird feeling for the first day or two. It felt like my toes were being like crammed into the toe box. But they have a 30-day return policy, so you can so long as they're still kind of new. If you feel like you want to back out of this and get your $80 back, you can send them back within 30 days. But yeah, I've been the long term thing is I've been sort of interchanging them with my regular sneakers and other shoes so that I'll give like my regular New Balance sneakers like sort of a day off every other day. They'll make those last a lot longer. And like I said, it makes me feel like I'm having a little bit more of a formal day, even though I'm wearing basically a slipper. They're available in like women's. They're available in women's sizes. They're also available in like more of a running shoe sort of look to them. But for $80, I was willing to take a flutter on them, and they actually worked out very very well.
So these are the Hanas that you like.
Hana, I think they. The women's version is called the Lana, I think.
Lena.
Something like that.
The Lena. Yeah. And, I might have to check these out because I'm always looking for something that is packable, highly packable.
Yeah, and I could on all the cruises that you go on, these would be like perfect for
walking around the boat. Yeah,
exactly. And I'll it's summer. It's beautiful. It's like 88 degrees outside. Like I've said before, where I moved, on a really beautiful weekend. There are all kinds of tourists down here. And the idea of like working like in my office and looking down and seeing men my age in cargo shorts and like those and like sandals with no socks on has reminded me that I don't look good in shorts and sandals with no socks on. But this still gives me the sort of walking around in a light, comfortable, like airy shoe without people seeing how hairy my toes are or and chalky and bony my toes are.
The Xero shoes. Feel the world.
They're on sale for $50 very recently. So if you're kind of on the edge, just keep taking a look. They might go on sale again.
Nice.
Okay, here you go. Two business cards from Steve Wozniak. Two steel business cards from Steve Wozniak.
Yeah, there's his wallet, folks. By the way, as Steve will point out, not only can you cut a steak with them, they also make a handy lock picking kit.
Outstanding.
I don't know. It just sounds like something Steve would do. My friend, the chat room says I skipped you last week. Did I do that, Andy? I'm sorry.
I think you might have. I don't know. But
I
assumed. I assumed that we were late, and I will have something next week.
Anytime that I skip you, just say, hey. Hey.
So long as I get paid, as long as I'm getting paid, not being paid by the word. I
can
say the same.
Yeah. Mr. Alex Lindsay.
So we were talking about Spotify, and I was talking about the fact that I make a lot of playlists, and I finally decided to publish one. So I figured I would. Renee said, you should publish one. And so I was like, okay. So I published it's on my Twitter feed, actually. But I'll put a link in here. But it's
Alexlindsay.
Yeah, and it's a summer mix. It's a good summer pool mix.
Alex's summer mix.
I'm quite happy with it. I'm constantly working on it. So the stuff at the very end is stuff that I've just added. I haven't figured out where to put it yet. So it's not, because I'm often thinking about what song should come after the next song and how it should look. But right now it's anyway,
people don't know that Alex was a DJ for many, many years.
Well, and then before that, a large portion of my childhood was making
mixtapes.
So
that's what we called them, kids.
Yeah, from the time I was like 10 years old, we were making them I used to make mixtapes off the radio. it was like
press
the first 10 seconds was cut off because I was like adding, hitting record on waiting for the next song that I wanted to play. And then my cousins would sit around and I would sit around with albums and make them. And so it was just kind of a nice groovy. It ranges all over the world. Some classic rock, some Brazilian, African, alternative. So it's kind of this wide ranging thing, and some of its inputs. The Justin Timberlake is mostly inputs from my daughter, who likes that song. So and Rude, I don't know that song very well, but I'm learning to like it. So anyway, there's a lot of fun there to be had if it's mostly designed if you're hanging out at the pool or outside, and you just want something that's kind of groovy that plays for 10 and a half hours. So I want them to be able to play all day. Anyway, so
very nice. Very nice.
If people like it, I have more. I don't need to make more. I have got 200 playlists on Spotify. I didn't put it on Apple Music because building playlists on Apple Music is really a pain.
Yes.
I couldn't find even where to do it on the desktop, and Spotify. I don't build any playlists on my iOS apps. I just build them on the desktop because it's too slow to do it on the apps. You can do it really fast on the desktop. So anyway, so that's why it's not on Apple Music. I'm trying to port it over. There's like I did a song swap or whatever, but there's like 14 songs missing. I have to figure out where they are in Apple Music and re-add them. I don't know what happened. Anyway, so enjoy. It's still the summer, so you can in half the world at least, so you can do that. And otherwise, it's a great winter mix.
I'm just buying some Xero shoes. Don't mind.
There you go,
Alex. If you are a believer, we would still love you anyway. We believe you when you say it's your kids.
Is there some in there? A little believer. Can you? Is there a way to export a Spotify playlist so I can use it on Apple Music?
Well, I use the app. I guess I could talk about that too. The app that I use to move things around is called SongShift on my phone. So SongShift will ask for permission from Spotify and ask for permission from Apple Music, and then I just pushes them. But it usually doesn't. It's usually not 100% for whatever reason. There's always like 10 or 15 songs that for some reason don't make it from one side to the other, and you have to go through by hand. They're named slightly differently or something else. And so, but it's been the most effective one that I've had. I don't, you know, just use it on my phone.
Nice. So download. Is there a way I could get your playlist? If I don't, I could use a free Spotify, download it, and then put it in my.
Yeah. And I'm going to put, as soon as I finish fixing the music, I kind of just did it on a whim, to post it. So I'm going to post the Apple Music one on my Twitter feed as well that I just have to,
let me show you something you could use on your Twitter feed. Uh-huh. This is so cool. itty.bitty.site, S-I-T-E, lets you make a web page that's entirely encoded in the URL. Mm. So you could do Alex's Spotify playlist.
Mm-hmm.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you know, like that. Uh-huh. All of that stuff. You could post a QR code, which would actually link to that site. Or you could post the URL, copy the link and share it via Twitter. It's encoded in a very long URL, but Twitter will shorten it. And then when people click the link, they go to this site at itty.bitty.site.
I'll try that.
Is that wild?
That's cool.
You can even do HTML. You can even do scripting. So, mm-hmm. folks, you should make sure you're going to a site you trust from a person you love.
Mm-hmm.
And that cast you love from a person you trust. My pick of the week, besides itty.bitty.site, which is pretty cool. You don't even need a web host or anything. Yeah. It's not even on their host. It's just, I don't know how it works. It's magic. is this interview with Andy Hertzfeld. Now, we've interviewed Bill Atkinson many times, and I love Bill and Andy. They are the creators of the original Macintosh. Bill created the Lisa before it. Andy talks about that and talks about the process. In an interview at Notion.so with a woman named Devin, who is a developer, and it's great. Highly recommend it. There's a YouTube video, or a video, I should say. I guess that's a YouTube video, yeah. That you could watch, Notion's Tools and Craft, an interview with Andy Hertzfeld. Or, yeah, actually, just go to Notion.so and you can do it there too. But I think really kind of neat, I want to celebrate this guy because he's a hero of mine and one of the sweetest guys I've ever met. I'm sure you guys have also met Andy, but it's been a real honor to get to know Bill Atkinson. Maybe we could try to get Andy on at some point too. She also throws in some pictures of his house, a corner of Andy's house. So that's kind of fun. That's kind of fun to see let's see what Andy's reading, right? You know, zoom in on his books. What is Andy reading these days? So Notion.so, nice job, Devin, on these interviews. And I just want to let everybody know about it because that's really, really cool. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now concluded our broadcast day, at least as regards to Apple. Thank you, Alex Lindsay. As
pleasure.
Always, happy birthday.
Thank you.
All of 70 years young.
74.
74. No, you're looking great, and it's great to see you. Although it's funny.
Good living, exercise.
Some of those original bits you did on the screensavers are on YouTube.
Are they?
It's kind of fun to see them. In fact, we were looking at this week on the new screensavers at old Twits, like Twit 22 that you were on.
Right.
And those were fun, too.
Back when I was in my 60s.
Back when you were... A youngin'. Follow him on Twitter. That's where all the good stuff, including the Spotify playlist, will be. Alexlindsay.
Yep.
We also thank you, Andy Iannocco. Always a pleasure to have you on. Remember, I have no idea how to spell it. IHNATKO.com.
It's like a phone number. If you think about it, you'll get it wrong. You just have
That's
to
right.
go with muscle memory.
Muscle memory. And if you've been listening to this show a long time, you probably have that muscle memory.
And Alex, can I ask you a question? If you were getting older looking, would we ever know if so long as it was on video?
Oh, that's a good point. That's a good point.
You know.
You're going to start wearing like motion tracking dots on your face everywhere so you can optimize later?
Well, actually, I've been coming to you via AR for the last 10 years. It was just getting, you know, that's how I've kept my youthful look is I just slowly turn it and I make the hair simulator a little whiter every year. And it just kind of keeps everybody thinking that it's working.
You know, you've done so many new screensavers now. I don't know if we can find any old screensavers. I'm going to look, though. And, of course, Rene Ritchie at iMore.com. Don't forget the Pokemon Go Hub at iMore.com.
Whatever makes you happy.
Whatever makes you happy. Actually, I'm going to be reading up on that, but also on the new iOS 12 and a whole lot more. Thank you all.
Have a good time at Fire Pokemon Festival, too.
Ooh, that'll be
fun. Thank you so much. Burning for the Y.
That'll be fun. Yeah, I'm looking. I don't see any old Alex Lindsay episodes. I know they're on here. I've seen them. But you've just done too much twit. And it's all mixed in with the twit.
It ruins everything.
Ruins it all. We do the Mac Break Weekly every Tuesday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 1800 UTC. Come on and watch us live. YouTube, it is on YouTube Live, but actually the easiest thing to do is go to twit.tv/live, and then you can pick the YouTube or the Twitch or the Mixer or whatever stream you like. There's also a live audio stream if you can listen. That's a good way to do it. It works, and no one knows. If you do watch the show live, do join us in the chat room at irc.twit.tv. You can also be in our studio audience if you'd like. Just email tickets at twit.tv. We'll make sure there's a chair ready for you to sit yourself down in. Now, if you can't be here live or watch live on the stream, you can also download on-demand audio and video of everything we do. It's available at twit.tv/mbw, or subscribe in your favorite podcast application. All of our shows are available that way as well. And a subscription is good for us. That way we know you'll be here every week, and that way you'll know automatically that you've downloaded the latest episode. Thanks for being here, but now I'm afraid it's hard to say it's time to get back to work because break time is over.